lurched forward, vision flashing red, black, white, the invisible hands in my mind already driving toward him. He couldn't have this. East River, Los Angeles, Jude, the research, Cole. He had taken so much, destroyed every trace of hope, just as it solidified into something real in my hands. He can't have this. We were too close. I was too close to finishing this. Nico brought me up short, stepping in front of me, brandishing the keys. Hands steady, expression focused, he unlocked each of the three deadbolts on the door.
Leave,
he said, throwing the door open.
Disappear again, the way you always do. Get out of here before you ruin everything for us. Call off the people you hired to get you out. Just disappear.
Clancy stood up from his cot, a strange expression on his face.
Don't you get it? Nico said. You haven't hurt the people who hurt you by doing this. You never will, and you won't admit it to yourself. You can't even get close to them. The only thing you've ever done is hurt the kids who wanted to help you. We all wanted to help you.
Then you should have stayed out of my way.
Why did you help the League get me out of Lita's program?
Nico asked, holding his ground as Clancy sauntered toward him.
You gave them the plan to extract me in Philadelphia, didn't you? But you were the one who left me behind at Thurmond. You left all of us, even after you told us we would get out together. We would be able to live without fear or shame or pain. Clancy, don't you remember the pain?
His voice dropped to a whisper.
Why couldn't you have just let me die like the others? You told me I had to live, but I wish I had died so you couldn't have used me.
Clancy was watching him, an expression on his face I'd never seen before.
Why do you have to take every good thing we try to give you and break it into pieces?
Nico said.
You let them turn you into this.
This is who I am, Clancy snapped. I won't let them change me. I won't let them touch me. Not again.
No one is going to force you to have the procedure,
Nico said, his hands up, placating.
You're free to go. You can disappear. Please, please, just call off the people who are coming. Please, Clance. Please?
I told you to stay out of this,
Clancy said, his voice shaking, even as he eyed the exit, even as I could see him considering it.
Why can't you ever listen?
Please,
Nico begged.
It's too late,
he said, hands fisted in his sweatpants.
If you weren't so stupid, you'd have realized that.
Can't you hear it? They're on the roof. They're here. But you could get them to leave. You can make sure they go.
He's working him, I realized, half amazed. Clancy was actually considering this, weighing Nico's words. I didn't move, too afraid I'd break the strange spell that had fallen over the room. My eyes kept darting between the two boys just outside of the cell. The tension in the room was softening, easing naturally.
Who's here?
Came a soft voice from the doorway.
Who did you call to get you?
And just like that, Clancy hardened again, shoving past Nico.
Hello, Mother. Were you hoping I'd leave without saying goodbye?
Who did you call?
She repeated, her stiff posture perfectly mimicking her son's.
Who do you think?
He said, all sweetness.
I called Dad.
I told you to leave, I barked at her.
No, stay, Clancy said. Clearly, last time didn't take. We'll have to try again. And this time, Ruby won't be there to help you.
There was a beat of silence, and then the whole building rocked, shuddering under the force of some kind of explosion. Clancy looked past her, toward the door, and in that moment, I was sure I had never hated him more.
The light caught the gun, my gun, the one that had been knocked out of my hands in the computer room, as Lillian Gray raised it and aimed at Clancy.
I love you, she said,
and fired. 23. A spray of blood burst from his shoulder, knocking him back against the glass wall. But Lillian wasn't finished. She took another step forward, ignoring her son's scream of pain, and aimed lower, this time firing at his leg. The whole time, her face was a cold mask, as if she'd had to shut off some crucial part of herself to see this through. Nico and I jumped with each shot. He covered his face and turned away so he wouldn't have to see it. I watched. I had to make sure he didn't get away this time. The ceiling shook, the sound of heavy footsteps thundering over our heads. We'd have minutes, maybe, before they found us. It would need to happen fast. And wouldn't you know it? The only thing I could think of as the old familiar calm came over me was one simple phrase. Accept. Adapt. Act. The certainty of it was more comforting than terrifying. That, too, seemed so strange. At some point, after pushing the possibility to the darkest corner of my mind, it had taken root and flourished. The old plan was gone. The new one bloomed in its place. The string around his neck holding the flash drive had slipped clear of Nico's shirt as he stumbled away from Clancy, falling back against the cell's glass wall. I was in front of him before he could catch his breath, gripping the black piece of plastic and yanking hard enough to snap the string he'd threaded it on. And before he could react, I shoved a shell-shocked Nico back into the empty cell and slammed the door shut.
No!
I had the keys. I barely heard the lock as it clanged into place.
No, no, no! He moaned. Ruby, you know what they'll do. They'll take you back to that place. They'll kill you! They'll kill you!
Dr. Gray had moved over to her son's side, dropping to her knees to apply pressure to his wounds. At that, she looked over, startled. I won't let them hurt me, I said, knowing what a hollow promise it was. But in that moment, I felt so sure of this plan, wanted so badly to make sure that it wasn't derailed in the aftermath of all this, that I felt confident I could, maybe, influence enough of the PSFs to keep my life. I want to live.
It was supposed to be me! It should be me!
Tell the others, march first, I said, pressing my palm against the glass and letting the keys fall to the floor. March first. Harry knows the plan.
Ruby, he sobbed. Don't do this!
I leaned my forehead against the cool glass and said quietly, I can see it now. The road Jude talked about. It's so beautiful. The rain's gone, and the clouds are moving out. I want to live. I shouldered Dr. Gray aside and reached to take Clancy under the arms, refusing to sag under his dead weight. I dragged him through the doorway, into the short hall.
What are you doing?
The woman trailed after me, her hands, shirt, face, all stained with her son's blood.
Where are you taking him?
Shut the door, I said sharply. Nico was still pressed up against the glass, slamming his palms against it, when Dr. Gray shut the door on that last image. I looked down at Clancy's dark head as I moved, listening to his half-conscious mutterings. The coppery stench of blood filled my nose. I looked down at my hands and thought, even now, he's staining me. They cut the power just as I pulled Clancy through the last door. He slid free of my hands, thumping bonelessly against the tile. I glanced back, making sure Dr. Gray had shut the last door, securing Nico safely inside. I slid the flash drive into my boot and lay down flat on my stomach, stretched out over the cold tile. I was proud of the fact that my hands didn't shake as I put them behind my head.
Breathe.
I went to that place deep inside, the one Zoo had asked me about.
I retreated as far as I could as the first beam of light slashed through the hallway's darkness. Fear couldn't touch me there, not even as I was hauled up by my hair and shoulder, a device flashing in my face. The dark spots in my vision blotted out the soldier's face, and I couldn't hear anything over my own steady heartbeat. When the grip on me tightened and something cold and metal pressed against the base of my skull, I knew they'd identified me. Clancy was hidden by a circle of men in dark fatigues as Dr. Gray was dragged off to the side, clawing at the soldier who separated her from her son. One of them, a medic, stepped away long enough for me to see them lower a white plastic muzzle down over his face. Radios buzzed, a swarm of voices flying over my head, and I heard none of it. Both of my hands were secured, the zip ties unbearable as the soldier holding me yanked them tight and flipped me over onto my back. Something jabbed into the side of my neck, and I felt the pressure of the injection being forced into my bloodstream. They are going to kill me. I wasn't even going to make it out of the building, never mind the state, if this didn't work. I should have practiced. I should have found a way to try it on a group when my life didn't rely on someone's trigger finger. The drug they'd given me turned my limbs to powder. I felt light enough to be blown away, but it couldn't touch my mind. Not yet. I fought against the drag of my eyelids, the weight that settled over them. I had one. I had one more thing to do. I'd spent months carefully winding my gift into a tight spool, only letting it out by inches, and only when I needed it. The strain of keeping it bound up had been a steady, constant reminder that I had to work to keep the life I'd built for myself out here. It was a muscle I'd carefully toned to withstand nearly any pressure. Letting it all go felt like shaking a bottle of soda and ripping off the cap. It fizzed and flooded and swept out of me, searching for the connections waiting to be made. I didn't guide it, and I didn't stop it. I don't know if I could have if I tried. I was the burning center of a galaxy of faces, memories, loves, heartbreaks, disappointments, and dreams. It was like living dozens of different lives. I was lifted and shattered by it. How strangely beautiful it was to feel their minds linked with my own. The spinning inside my head slowed with the movement around me. I felt time hovering nearby, waiting to resume its usual tempo. The darkness slid into the edges of my vision, seeping through my mind like a drop of ink in water. But I was in control of the moment, and there was one last thing that I needed to say to them. One last idea to imprint in their minds. I'm green. I woke to cold water and a woman's soft voice. The smell of bleach, the aftertaste of vomit, dry throat, cracked, tight lips. The metallic banging and clattering of an old radiator in the instant before it let out a warm breath of air. We need to run the test while subject is conscious. Wake up, I commanded myself. Wake up, Ruby. Wake up. Good. There cannot be any confusion on this, do you understand? I dragged myself up and out of a haze of pain and grogginess. My eyes were crusted with sleep. I tried lifting a hand up to wipe it away, to ease the tingling at the tips of my fingers. The Velcro restraint jerked, but held firm, cutting into my bare wrists with a vicious bite as I tried to rise up off the freezing metal examination table. The cold water hadn't been water at all, but sweat. It dripped down into the white plastic muzzle, trapping each labored, heated breath. The black spots floating in my vision cleared, adjusting to the room's harsh artificial light. The pieces began to make sense. The poster on the wall, the one with the color chart outlining each of the abilities, red to green, Psi classification system. My lips formed the words on top. High up in the corner of the room,
A lidless camera eye was blinking like a heartbeat. Calm down, Ruby. The rational part of my brain was still firing, at least. Calm down. You're alive. Calm down. It was sheer will and nothing else that finally brought my pulse back down. I breathed in through my nose, out between my teeth. This was Thurmond, the infirmary. I recognized the lemon-scented terror of it and the sounds of kids crying nearby, the rattling of carts, heavy booted footsteps, and still some part of it felt unreal to me, even as the last moments at the ranch slammed back into me. The flash drive. My boots were still on. They hadn't taken them, thank God. I tried twisting my foot around the restraints, but I couldn't feel it against my ankle bone. I flexed and then pointed my toes, nearly crying in relief when I felt the sharp plastic corners under my heel. It must have slipped down. You came here for a reason, I reminded myself. The others need you to finish this. You have to finish this. I squeezed my eyes shut, trying to block out the images that poured in from the darkest corner of my imagination. They wouldn't have brought you here if they were just going to kill you. I saw the image of Ashley's pale gray face, the way her stiff hand had fallen onto the ground, dangling into the ditch they would lower her into. Maybe this was about having an official record of where my body was buried. And suddenly, it didn't matter what I was and what I had been through. I was 10 years old all over again, waiting in terrible silence for someone to wake me back up from the nightmare I'd let myself get caught in. Help me, I thought. Someone, help me. Jim? I squeezed my eyes shut against the familiar voice whispering in my ear, choked again, this time by grief. Don't let me screw it up. Please, help me, I thought. I was alone here. I knew I would be, and somehow I had misjudged how terrifying it would be. I reached for the image of Cole's face and held it at the forefront of my mind. He wouldn't be afraid. He wouldn't leave me.
You have to walk out of here.
I felt the words settle in my mind.
Not just for them, but for yourself. You have to walk out of here on your own 2 feet.
The door cracked open, and the sounds from the rest of the building came flooding in. An old man's face appeared there, gray hair wringing his head like a cluster of old dust. His eyes narrowed behind his glasses, but I didn't recognize him. Not until he stepped inside, and I sucked in a lungful of his terrible scent. Alcohol and lemon soap. Dr. Fremont, still haunting the halls of this place. The man let out a noise of surprise.
She's awake.
Another face appeared directly behind his, a woman in gray scrubs who was quickly pushed aside to allow 2 PSFs in the room. Their black uniforms were pristine, from their polished boots to the stitched red sigh on their chests. I saw their faces, and it was like living inside of a memory. The moment took on an unreal quality. Focus. One last person entered the room. He was middle-aged, with sandy hair that turned silver under the lights. His uniform was different than that of the soldiers, a black button-down with matching slacks. I knew this uniform, but I'd only seen it once up close. Camp Controller. One of the men and women who worked in the control tower, monitoring the cameras, keeping the day's schedule.
Ah, there you are, Dr. Fremont began. I was just about to begin the test.
The man, his shirt was embroidered with the name Orion, stepped up, sweeping a hand forward, a clear go-ahead. I set my jaw, fingers curling into fists. I knew better than to ask what was happening, but I read the situation quickly enough to put together a guess. The old man pulled a small, handheld white noise machine out of his pocket and adjusted a dial on it. All the times I'd envisioned this plan playing out, I had seen myself influencing the camp controllers and PSFs one at a time, planting the suggestion that I was really a Green, working my way through each of them as our paths crossed. But I saw now, as the doctor's finger pressed down on the device's largest button, that I didn't have to influence dozens, just four.
"This is Green," Dr. Fremont said.
The sound that came out of the device was softer than I expected, as if I was hearing it from several floors above me. The shrill pitch and blended mess of beeping and buzzing made the hair on the back of my neck stand up and my stomach tighten, but it was nothing compared to the white noise they used over the camp's loudspeakers. "They're seeing what frequency I can hear," I thought. "Shit." Our brains translated sounds differently than a normal human mind. If the adults in the room heard the sound, it was nothing more than a buzzing fly around their ears. There was a spectrum of pitches that affected us, each of them specially tuned to sing for each different color. I'd learned about it when Kate and the League had managed to embed the regular white noise with tones meant for oranges and reds, hoping to root out those of us who might have been in hiding or posing as a different color. That sound, the thread of mind-blistering crashes and bangs, had drilled through me and left me unconscious. I strained against the Velcro cuffs, letting my eyes bulge, letting my whole body shake and thrash, as if the sound were a knife driving repeatedly into my chest. The sounds that escaped the muzzle were low animal moans. Orion held up a hand, and the faint noise switched off. He stepped up closer to the bed, peering down at my face. I had to force my hatred into fear.
"Successful reaction," Dr. Fremont said. "Should I?"
The camp controller's face was impassive, though I saw his lip curl up in assessment. I got a good look at him now. His wide shoulders filled out his shirt, and, standing over me, he seemed 10 feet tall. There was something in his stance that reminded me of a knife's blade. He stood rigidly proud, his eyes cutting through every layer of control I'd built up, and I realized, a second too late, that this wasn't a normal camp controller. This was the camp controller. And I was looking him in the eye. I tore my gaze away, but the damage had been done. I'd shown too much will. He'd read it as a challenge.
"Set it to orange."
There was a lot I could withstand now, but I knew a hit of that white noise would be like stepping in front of a speeding train. Orion stood over me, staring at my face. He thought he was in control here, didn't he? That if he looked at me close enough, he'd detect me using my abilities. That if the muzzle kept me from speaking, I couldn't issue a command. I didn't need to look at him. I didn't need to speak to him. And, in the end, I only needed to affect one person. Dr. Fremont's mind was a swamp of faceless children and computer screens. I planted the images there, in the middle of them all, a neat, tidy package based on what I could remember from my first processing through the camp, and pulled back immediately. I pushed the image of him fiddling with the dial, pulling it back toward his chest as he turned the dial back to its original setting. He was angled away from the PSFs at the door. Orion was looking at me, so smug and sure of himself that he allowed himself a knowing smirk. I lowered my lashes, glad for the first time that there was a muzzle to keep me from returning it.
"Begin," he said.
It was easy enough to float the command to Dr. Fremont to push the button. I'd seen him do it moments ago, and could choreograph the small movement the exact way the doctor had done before. The white noise trickled out again, running along my skin like an electric current. I let my eyes flick around, but it was harder to mime fear now. A swell of cool, careful control settled my mind. Orion looked back over his shoulder.
"Turn it on."
"It is on," I thought.
"It is on," Dr. Fremont said.
I froze at the dull tone of his voice, risking a glance toward Orion for his reaction. The camp controller's lip pulled back.
I'm ordering one of the testing machines back from New York.
New York? Had they moved all of the big testing machines and scanners out already? I forced the words into the doctor's mouth.
That could take weeks.
That could take weeks, Dr. Fremont said.
This is foolproof.
This is foolproof.
Orion's gaze was searing as it moved between the old man and me. I let my control expand, snaring the camp controller's mind. I skimmed the surface memories, the damp mornings, fog, streams of children in uniforms, but it took a forceful shove to break past them, to plant the idea. This girl is green. She was mistakenly identified as orange.
I pulled back, slipping out of both of their minds, shifting my gaze to the tiled floor. Fine. The orange classification was an error.
Orion turned to one of the PSFs.
Get one of the green uniforms and shoes out of the boxes. Her PID is 3285.
What size, sir?
Does it matter? Orion barked. Go!
The doctor blinked.
Will she not stay here, then? I imagine it might be disruptive to the other children if they saw her.
One night is enough.
He turned to look at me as he added,
I want them all to understand. No matter how far they run, they'll always be found. They'll always be brought back.
A whole night? Jesus, the drugs they'd given me had knocked me sideways hard enough to lose a full day. The military would have flown us back east to West Virginia. They wouldn't have risked ground transportation. Meaning, that would make it the 25th of February. Shit, 3 days to figure this out. The doctor didn't uncuff me or remove the muzzle until the PSF was back, dropping the thin cotton uniform and laceless white slip-on sneakers on the examination table.
Change,
Orion ordered, tossing them onto my chest.
Move!
The smell of black permanent marker flooded my nose as I picked them up, working my sore jaw back and forth. If it was a muscle or a joint, it hurt, but I didn't want to give them the satisfaction of limping, as I stood up and moved to the corner of the room to begin stripping, aware of their eyes on my back the entire time. I began with my shoes, unlacing them quickly, tilting the right one back to pluck the black flash drive out of it. My hands felt swollen and clumsy as I slid it into my new shoe, pretending to adjust the cloth tongue. They were two sizes too big, at least, but it didn't matter to anyone watching me. My face burned with hatred as I faced the wall and stripped out of my clothes. The uniform slid over my freezing skin like the dull side of a blade. When I was finished, I turned back and kept my head bowed. The PSF who'd gone to get the uniform, Laybrook, stepped up and gripped my arm.
Cabin 27,
Orion said, the corner of his mouth twisting up in a mocking smile.
We kept your bed open for you, knowing we'd see you again. I'm sure you remember the way.
Orion gave a small signal with his hand, and I was hauled, literally pulled, out of the door and into the hall. Laybrook wrenched my arm again as we turned into the nearest stairwell. God, I could almost see it, all of those little kids trailing up the other direction, not knowing what was waiting for them. I saw myself in my pajamas, Sam in her coat. The pace was impossible to keep up with. I slipped, nearly falling onto my knees as we reached the first landing. Laybrook's expression darkened with irritation as he gripped the back of my shirt and neck, bringing me back up onto my feet. This is how it's going to be, I thought, with all of them. I got out. I got out and beat their system. And now what? They had to prove to me it would never happen again? That I was just as small and powerless at 17 as I was at 10? They wanted me to stay in that shadowy corner I'd let myself be backed into, fold myself up small, cut myself off from the others. They wanted to take everything away again, strip me down to nothing.
I snapped.
I glanced back up the steps we'd come down and shifted my gaze toward the next set until it finally landed on the black camera watching overhead. Once we were out of its line of sight, turning the corner to start down the next flight of stairs, I bent my arm, threw my elbow up into Laybrook's throat, and held it there. I glared up through the inches that separated his stunned face from mine and slammed into his mind. His rifle clattered against the wall, the strap sliding from his shoulder. The man had decades on me and at least 100 pounds. But in the end, it didn't matter. We'd be going at my pace from this point on. Orion had been right about one thing, at least. I did remember the way back to Cabin 27. My fear remembered it, too, and I had to fight to keep myself from swaying as the camp spread open in front of me. It was just that some things had changed in the months I'd been gone. The lower level of the infirmary had been little more than a hallway of beds and curtains, but all of those were gone now, replaced by stacked, unlabeled boxes. As we moved across the tile, the plastic in my shoe clicking with each stride, I saw PSFs bringing more up from the back rooms and offices. Their curious gazes followed us all the way outside into the pouring rain. Gunmetal gray skies always drew out the vibrant green of the grass and the trees surrounding the fence. The curtain of water falling around us in sheets didn't dampen the effect in the slightest, nor did it drive away the earthy smell that immediately sent my senses into an overload of visceral memory. I bit my lip and shook my head. "It's different now," I reminded myself. "You're in control. You are getting out of here." I tried to reach for the old, familiar, numb nothing I had lived inside while in this camp, but couldn't find it. The soggy ground shifted under my feet as I found the muddy path. I looked down, and my eyes caught on the sight of the white slip-ons on my feet. The number 3285 stared back, splattered with filthy water and wilted grass. I took a steadying breath and forced myself forward. "You're here for a purpose. You are going to get out of here." This was another op. I could be hard and certain and fight here, too. There was no falling apart now, no giving in to fear, not if I was going to save the others. Rings of cabins curved in front of me, looking darker and smaller than I remembered. I saw holes in the roofs patched over with sheets of warped plastic. The wood paneling along the sides was warping, peeling as the remnants of the last snowstorm dripped down from the roofs. The cold ran like needles over my skin, pinching and stabbing until I finally gave in and started to shiver. The red brick control tower at the center of the cabins had darkened under the rain's touch, but there were still multiple PSFs out on the upper ledge, their guns following the paths of each line of drenched kids trudging up the paths from the garden. Their blue uniforms clung to their shoulders, the hollows of their stomachs. Most of the kids kept their heads down as they diverted around us, but I caught a few curious glances, all lightning fast, under the watchful eye of their PSF escort. No, not PSF. I spun on my heel, watching as the soldiers at the end of the line marched on, backs straight, movements choreographed and stiff. They wore crimson vests over their black fatigues. I guided Laybrook off the path with the slightest bit of pressure on his arm, letting the next group pass by us to reach their cabins. Again, walking alongside them at the front and back of the two straight rows were the soldiers in crimson vests. No guns, no weapons of any kind. A warning trill sounded in my mind as the last group came toward us, and terrible suspicion solidified into shock. The red vests were keeping track of the kids, devoid of any emotion. They were young, faces still round and full, my age maybe or a few years older. They were inserted in the places where the dwindling PSF force should have been. They were Reds. 24. There was an hour between the last work shift, whether it was in the garden, the factory, or cleaning in the mess hall or washrooms, and when they served dinner. The kids would be returned to their cabins, and each group was allotted a specific time to walk the distance between the buildings. It was a song that only worked if the camp hit each note exactly right. The kids were streams of blue and green, so deeply entrenched in playing their parts that they never stepped out, not even once, to dare interrupt the pace. Reds. God, the others had no idea. I had no way of warning them, and the closer I came to Cabin 27, the more it felt like this was already over. Laybrook followed me up to the cabin, unlocking the door and holding it open for me with a forced politeness. I stepped inside, my eyes meeting his pale ones for the last time. I plugged memories in over the truth, dropped in scenes of him roughing me up, dragging me around, and made him think he was as tough as he wanted to be. The door shut automatically as he turned and walked back into the rain. I knew, by the silence that had greeted me when the door opened, that the girls weren't back yet. They would have switched, just recently, from factory to garden duty, and likely were still trudging back through the mud, or waiting at the low fence for permission to move. The cabin, my cabin, was small enough to take in with a single turn. Brown upon brown, broken up only by the yellowing white sheets on the bunk bed. The smell of mildew mixed with a natural body odor, covering even the bland hint of sawdust from the wood. Patches of silver light streamed in through the cracks in the paneling. The wind whispered through the cabin, drawing me around the first few sets of bunks, toward the back wall. I stared at my bunk, a familiar, hopeless despair crashing over me. I bit my lip again to keep from crying. Rain had come in through the nearby wall, slanting in to dampen the mattress. I moved toward it like I was underwater, barely feeling it as I sat down. My breath caught in my throat and stayed there as I looked up at the bottom of Sam's mattress. My fingers traced the shapes I had peeled off at night when I couldn't sleep. You left them here. A hand rose up, pressing against my chest, making sure my heart was still beating. You left them here, to live in this hell. Stop, I whispered. Stop. There was no way I could ever make up for it. There was no way to go back and change the decision I made that night to swallow Kate's pills. The only way out was forward. I am going to walk out of here. I am going to take every single one of them with me. The door to the cabin popped open. They were silent as they came in, lining the narrow space between the nearby bunks. The PSF came in, counting them off. Then, with a faint smirk, she turned and added me to the tally. The others knew better than to move before the uniform left and locked the door behind her, but nothing could have surprised me more than seeing Sam whirl around, something like hope on her face. Her honey blonde hair had been hastily braided back, and her face was streaked with black dirt. She looked tired, pushed past the point of exhaustion, but her stance, the hands on her hips, the expectant tilt of her head, that was Sam. That was all Sam.
Oh my God!
Ellie, one of the older girls. She and Ashley had always tried the hardest to take care of the younger girls. Without her best friend standing shoulder to shoulder with her, I barely recognized her. There was a beat of stillness, and then she was rushing toward me, climbing over the bunks that separated us. A good thing, too. I'm not sure I could have moved if I'd wanted to. How was it possible to be bursting with happiness at the sight of them and still terrified about what they'd think?
Oh, my God.
Those three words over and over again. Ellie crouched down in front of me, her green shirt splattered with rain. She took my face between her freezing hands, a light touch that turned into a fierce grip once she seemed to accept I was real.
Ruby? I'm back,
I choked out. The other girls bottlenecked the path between the bunks, and some, Sam included, simply crawled over the mattresses and frames that stood between them and me. Vanessa, Macy, Rachel,
all of them, reaching out, touching my face, the hands that were limp in my lap. Not angry, not accusing, not afraid. Don't cry, I told myself, smiling even as my eyes burned behind my lashes. They said that you died, Ellie said, still kneeling in front of me. That it was IAAN. What happened? They took you away that night and you never came back.
I got out, I told them. One of the nurses planned the whole thing. I met other kids like us and we hid. The abbreviated truth would have to do, for now. I'd never bothered to ask Kate if the cameras could record sound in addition to video, but the sight of them gathered around me would be dangerous enough. We weren't supposed to touch each other.
But they found you?
This from Vanessa, dark eyes still wide with disbelief.
Do you know if they took Ashley, too? Have you heard anything about her?
What happened? I asked, careful to keep my tone measured. They pulled her in to work in the kitchen, maybe 2 months ago, Ellie said. That wasn't anything out of the ordinary. If there were specific small tasks or if they needed an additional hand somewhere like the kitchen or the laundry, they would pull from the older green kids, thinking they were trustworthy, I guess.
That night, they wouldn't let us eat in the mess, and then she just didn't come back. Do you know if someone got her out?
They were all staring at me, and the hope in their eyes was unbearable. What would the truth do to them? I don't know if it was kindness or cowardice that made me say, I don't know.
What was it like? One of them asked. Outside.
A faint laugh escaped my lips as I looked up. Strange and so loud. Terrifying, violent, but open, wide open, and beautiful. I looked up into each of their faces, starving, desperate for something outside of the fence.
Almost ready? For what?
Ellie asked. For us. After we ate the bread and tasteless soup they served in the mess hall for dinner, we made our way back to the cabin again, a red shadowing our every step, arms swinging at his side. They'd shaved his hair down to dark fuzz beneath his uniform cap, let his tanned skin go sallow. There was nothing in his eyes, not a trace of emotion in his face. During dinner, I'd had to look away to keep my heart steady and caught Sam doing the same. He'd stopped behind her at one point. She'd dropped her spoon into her bowl and stopped pretending she wanted to eat. But afterwards, I saw her look at his back, eyes devouring his shape, and I wondered. Up until that moment, I had managed to clear my thoughts of what was happening to the others, what they were doing, if they were safe, whether or not they were actually coming. I couldn't let it distract me from what needed to happen here. Just thinking of Liam out there alone, trying to find his parents to tell them what had happened. As we walked, I shifted my thoughts to sweet, small memories instead. Laughter at dinner, firelight on Zoo's smiling face, Jude falling over himself and Nico when one of their handmade toy cars worked, the way Pat and Tommy had worshipped the ground Vida walked on, seeing Chubbs in North Carolina for the first time in months and knowing he was alive, Cole's easy smile as he reached over and smoothed down my hair. Liam. Liam in the driver's seat, singing along. Liam kissing me in the dark. I am going to walk out of here. I am going to live. Sam was tracking me now out of the corner of her eye, the skin tightened around her lips, pulling their corners down. There was still a hooked scar, a faint pink line curving to connect the chapped upper lip to her nose, but that, like the rest of her, had faded. And when I turned to meet her gaze, she only looked away. I knew Sam, though. A year apart, 3 years since I'd blanked out every memory she had of me, and I still could read her face like it was my old favorite book. She got braver as time went on, less uncertain about my presence. The thoughts were working behind her light-colored eyes, and she watched me from the moment the morning alarm went off at 5 a.m. through the entire 10 minutes we were allotted to eat oatmeal in the mess hall, and then next to me as we made our way through the damp, freezing morning air to begin the day's work. I'd noticed her slight limp the night before as we moved to and from the mess hall, but her right leg was clearly stiffer that morning, and the movement was more pronounced.
"What happened?"
I whispered, watching her catch herself on the edge of her bunk. The moment she slid over the side of her bed and down to the ground, her ankle collapsed under her. I leaned over to help her make up her bed, since no one had bothered to give me sheets to use on mine, and tried to see what had caused it. In their typical, casual cruelty, the PSF in the infirmary had given me a summer uniform set, shorts and a shirt, but the others wore their winter ones, long-sleeved shirts and pants. The loose fabric hid whatever it was that was bothering her.
"Snake bite,"
Vanessa answered as Sam pushed past me to line up.
"Don't ask. She won't talk about it."
The garden was all the way at the far end of the camp, opposite the entry gate. The electrified fence sang to you when you got this close to it. When I was younger, I used to imagine that the hum came from families of bugs that lived in the trees surrounding us. I don't know why that made it feel more bearable. Our red escort was the same boy we'd had the night before, hair shaved, eyes dark and almond-shaped. Beside me, Sam cringed, her hands balled up tight at her sides, and limped along.
"They took the life out of them,"
I thought, stepping through the low white fence and taking the small plastic shovel that was handed to me. I knew so little about how they had been, what had Clancy called it, reprogrammed, reconditioned. Mason had been shattered by what they'd done to his mind. Maybe they'd made a mistake with him, or he hadn't been strong enough to take what they'd dealt him. How many Reds were involved in Project Jamboree? Was it possible that... No. "Stop it," I ordered myself. "Think about anything else but that." A PSF was passing out heavy work coats, which they allowed us to have while we were out here. He looked down at the number across my chest and skipped me completely. The 10-year-old me would have accepted the punishment, mind fixed on the cruel smile the soldier offered in exchange instead. But I didn't have to accept anything now. His mind was like glass, and all I had to do was pass through it like a ray of light. I shuffled back, taking the coat from him. I followed my line down to the mounds of earth they'd turned up yesterday and knelt down. The dirt gave way under the softest touch, packing beneath my nails as I used the shovel to ease the buried potatoes up from the ground. I brushed the dark dirt away. The shade of burnt skin. I pressed the back of my hand against my mouth, instinctively looking up at the three red vests standing near the entrance. They stoically watched as each cabin of kids filed in and accepted their assignments.
Are they the same Reds?
My fingers flexed, tightening around the shovel. I glanced sideways to my right. Sam was only miming work, smoothing dirt away. Still, after all this time, they forced us into alphabetical order.
"How long have they been here?"
I asked in a low voice.
"The Reds."
At first, I wasn't sure she'd heard me. I pulled the next potato up and dropped it into the plastic tub between us.
3 months, maybe,"
was the reply, just as quiet.
"I'm not sure."
I sagged slightly, blowing out a soft sigh. They weren't sawtooth Reds, but that meant more camps, more reconditioning facilities.
Don't you recognize some of them?"
Sam whispered, leaning over as if to help me.
"A few of them used to be here."
I couldn't risk another glance back to confirm this. I'm not sure I would have been able to anyway. The Reds at Thurmond had always lived in my memory with shadowed faces. All of the dangerous ones did. But I knew for certain that I didn't recognize the Red that Sam kept searching for. Every time she found him, she shuddered and oriented herself away from his gaze. But, like clockwork, she'd look up at him again.
Do you know him?
I whispered. She hesitated so long, I didn't think she would answer. But finally, she nodded.
From before? Before?
Sam swallowed hard, then nodded again. Sympathy swept through me, leaving me at a loss for what to say. I couldn't imagine. I couldn't begin to imagine what this felt like. A PSF passed behind us, whistling without a tune, making his way up the rows between each patch of vegetation. The garden was enormous, at least half a mile long, and required the most supervision. The handheld white noise machine clattered against his supply belt, swaying in time to his slow steps. I risked another glance up, realizing why my skin had crawled the moment he came into sight. This was one of the PSFs who oversaw work in the factory, the one who liked to press himself up against the girls, hassle them to get them flustered, and then punish them for reacting in any small way. It hadn't made sense then what he was doing to me, to Sam, to the other girls, and we'd just stood there and taken it silently. Now, though? Now I had a pretty good sense of what he'd really been doing, and it lit my fury. He strolled by us, and Sam stiffened. I wondered if she could smell him, too, a salty, sharp tang of vinegar mixed with cigarette smoke and aftershave. I didn't relax until he was a good 10 girls away from us.
Ruby,
Sam whispered, earning admonishing glances from the girls working the row across from us.
Something happened after you left. I realized something was wrong. With me. My head.
My sight narrowed to the hole in front of me. Nothing's wrong with you.
I missed you, she said. So much. But I barely know you. And then I get these senses, these images. They come like dreams.
I shook my head, fighting to keep my pulse steady.
Don't you dare. You can't. If anyone catches on, if she slips up. You're different,
Sam finished.
Aren't you? You've always been...
Sam was ripped away, hauled back and away from my side. I whirled around. The PSF from before was back, his hand knotted in Sam's long ponytail.
You know the rules, he snarled. We work silently or we don't work at all.
For the first time, I saw what this past year had done to my friend. The old Sam, the one who had stood up for me countless times, would have spat back an insult or tried to twist out of his grasp, struggled in some small way. Now, her dirt-stained hands went up to protect herself without a beat of hesitation, a practiced movement. Her whole body sagged as he shoved her forward, sending her sprawling into the mud. Fury whipped through me, and then it wasn't enough for me that I would kill this man, eventually. I wanted to humiliate him. I pushed a single image into his mind, an urge that was easy enough to suggest. The front of his black camo pants darkened, the stain spreading down his leg. I jumped back in overblown disgust, catching the attention of another PSF just across the row of vegetation. He came back to himself with a shudder, and with slow, dawning horror, looked down.
Shit!
Tilden, the PSF who'd been watching called out.
Status?
Shit!
The man's face burned pink as he covered himself, seemingly torn between staying as he was or excusing himself to take care of the situation. Kids were sneaking glances at him, at each other. He seemed to realize it, too, and rose on unsteady feet. I had just enough of a grip left on his mind to slide my right leg out to the side and listen as his own leg mirrored the response and sent him crashing to his knees just before he reached the gate. The PSF, Tilden, he'd think he had tripped over someone. The image was the last one I planted before gently peeling back from his mind, refusing to watch as he walked briskly in the direction of the control tower. Too much, I chastised myself. Next time, I'd have to go for something subtler. But this one I wouldn't regret, no matter what. I rose unsteadily onto my feet to help Sam back onto hers, guiding her back over to our places. She was shaking, staring at me as if she knew what had really happened. "Fix it," she whispered. "Whatever you did to me. Please, I need to know." I couldn't bring myself to look at her, knowing what sort of expression I'd see there. It had been like this with Liam, hadn't it? All of the feelings, none of the memories. That's what I'd left her with. No wonder she had seemed so confused and hostile after I'd wiped her memory. It must have been overwhelming. If she'd felt half as close to me as I did to her, the strange sense that something was wrong must have torn at her each day. I met her pleading eyes with a plea of my own, and just like always, she understood. A spark of the old Sam surfaced. Her eyebrows drew together, and she pursed her lips. This was the silent language we'd developed over the years. The PSF, who'd been gazing in our direction, hand shading his eyes to make out Tilden's distant form growing smaller and smaller, stepped over the mounds into our row. I tensed, waiting to feel his shadow cast over me. "Try it," I thought. "Try it with any of these kids and see where it gets you." Instead, he walked away, continuing the watch that Tilden had been forced to abandon. I held my breath and slid my hand over, under the loose dirt, to grip Sam's. We worked through the morning into the afternoon, with only a small break to eat the apples and sandwiches they distributed for lunch. I devoured mine with dirt-stained hands, watching the changing colors of the sky. And that night, as I lay in the bunk beneath her, I slipped into Sam's mind as soft as a breeze. I thought of that morning I'd stepped up beside her in the infirmary, the way her coat's tag had flipped up against her neck, the exact moment I'd taken her memories of me by mistake, the heaviness in my chest still unbearable as the moment played through. The images were in her mind now, too, perfectly matched with mine. I was swept along with them, falling through the white, fluttering images around me. Her memories were almost too bright to watch, the wisps too thin to grasp. But I knew what I was looking for when I saw it. The black knot buried deep beneath the others. I reached out, touching it, increasing the pressure until it unraveled. If each memory that drifted up were a star, I was standing at the center of a galaxy, beneath vast constellations of lost smiles and quiet laughter, whole endless days of gray and brown and black that we'd spent with only each other to hold on to. I'd assumed she'd been asleep the whole time. Her mind had been so calm and still under my touch. But a pale arm came down over the side of the bunk, stretching down toward me. The familiar gesture stole the air from my chest, and I had to press my lips together to keep back the tears that came dangerously close to the surface. I reached up, meeting her halfway, locking my fingers around hers. A secret. A promise. 25. My plan came to me in pieces over the next 2 days. I assembled it hastily while I worked in the garden, ignoring the blisters on the palm of my hand, and in those minutes before I passed out in exhausted sleep each night. Knowing that it would be over soon, in a matter of hours, made me feel reckless in a way I hadn't expected. Somehow it was too much time, and yet still not enough. I couldn't shake the fear that the others had changed their timing from the original plan that Cole, Nico, and I had outlined. I'd told them March 1st, but what if it was impossible to get here in time? What if they're not coming at all? I shoved the thought away before it could plant itself too deeply in my heart. At 6 o'clock that evening, I lay in my bunk, hands folded on my stomach. Sam's mattress shifted as she rolled onto her side, distorting the shapes I had made in the plastic. I reached up, taking a small piece of the curling plastic cover between my broken fingernails.
Tugging gently, I pulled the strip off, carefully working it around, around, until it formed an even circle. So the girl, after the robbers decided to take her away, she managed to steal one of their daggers and cut the rope off her hands. Rachel was leading the story today, filling in the hour before we were called to dinner. Tonight, she wove the tale of yet another nameless girl in yet another perilous situation. I closed my eyes, a faint smile on my lips. The stories hadn't gotten any better or any more original. They all followed the same plot. Girl is wronged, girl struggles, girl escapes. The ultimate fantasy at Thurmond. Physical exhaustion kept me still. As much as I had trained at the ranch, these hours of endless work with no break, unlimited food and water, were designed to drain us of the energy we'd need to muster to escape or push back. My body was a mess of quivering muscles, but I felt oddly calm, even though I knew what would happen if I made one misstep, or they figured out what I was before I could complete what I'd come here to do. I have to walk out of here. Ruby? Ellie called from her bunk at the center of the room. It's your turn. I shifted onto my elbows, scooting back to swing my legs off the cramped bunk. I worked out the kinks in my lower back as I thought about how I was going to finish this story. The girl. When I was younger, I would have passed it on to Sam after adding only a few words, but I could use this. I wasn't sure they would understand, but I hoped some part of them would recognize the warning when the time came. The girl cut herself loose from the rope and knocked the bandit off the horse in front of her. She took the reins and turned the horse around in the road, heading back in the direction they had come from, back toward the castle. There was a murmur at that. Vanessa had spent the better part of 15 minutes describing the battle raging outside of its walls. It had provided the distraction the bandits needed to take the girl in the first place. She used the darkness, I explained. She left her horse in the nearby forest and crept toward a passage she knew was hidden in the far stone wall. The fighting had stopped once the knights in black had taken the castle. They locked the white knights out, and they were unable to help the families trapped inside. But no one noticed a small, plain girl coming through the back door. She looked like a helpless servant girl, bringing a basket of food into the kitchen. For days, she stayed in the castle, watching, waiting for the right moment. And then it came. She slipped back outside and made her way through the shadows of night, unlocking the gate for the white knights to come pouring back in. Why would she come back? Why didn't she just escape? Hide, Sam asked, her voice small. I blew out a soft breath, glad that, if nothing else, she understood. Because, I said finally, in the end, she couldn't leave her family behind. The girls shifted silently in their bunks, looking at each other as if wondering the same thing. No one asked the question. I don't know how many of them actually dared to hope. But 3 short minutes later, the electronic lock on the cabin's door popped open. The door swung in and a PSF stepped inside. Line up, she barked. We hastily assembled in alphabetical order, staring straight ahead as she counted us off. She motioned for the girls at the front of the line to start moving. I couldn't help myself. A step before we reached the door, I glanced back behind me. No matter what happened, it would be the last time I ever saw Cabin 27. But when we walked through the door of the mess hall that evening, I already had to revisit a key component of my plan, because, set up against the wall opposite of us, to the left of the window where we lined up to receive our food, was a large white screen. Orion stood in front of it, his arms crossed over his chest, the blue light from a digital projector washing over him. Sam threw a nervous look my way as our PSF escort pushed her toward our table. The last time we'd seen them use this screen had been our first week here.
The camp controllers had set up the projector to scroll through the list of camp rules. No talking during work duties. No talking after lights out. Do not speak to a Psi Special Forces officer unless spoken to first. On and on and on. Rather than have us line up to get food, the PSF signaled for us to sit down and remain seated. The energy in the room was unsettling. I couldn't get a read on any of the camp controllers or PSFs.
"There have been some recent developments," Orion said, his natural voice loud enough to carry through the building. "Regarding your situation, pay attention. You will only be shown this once."
The move, I thought. They were finally going to tell them about closing the camp. Orion stepped back as the lights were dimmed slightly. A computer was hooked up to the projector, giving us a glimpse of a desktop before the video window expanded and the PSF hit play. The video wasn't about the move. Next to me, Sam actually recoiled, her hand reaching for mine. I blinked in horrified disbelief. It was a sight I hadn't seen in 8 years. President Gray standing at a podium in front of the crest of the White House. He smiled so generously that dimples appeared on his cheeks. He waved, beckoned, to someone out of the camera's frame, and, this time, the room full of reporters and cameras in front of him burst into sound as a pale-haired woman stepped up beside him, dressed in an immaculate suit. Dr. Lillian Gray.
"I've never been one to bury the lead, have I?"
President Gray laughed. The First Lady disappeared into the fevered flashing of the cameras. The furious clicking of camera shutters would have put any machine gun to shame.
"It's good to be home in Washington again, to be back in this room with all of you and with my beautiful wife. She's alive and well, contrary to wild speculation."
Nervous laughter in response.
"Her appearance here means that, at long last, I can tell you that our prayers have been answered, and we now have a safe treatment that will rid American children of the psionic disorder forever," he said.
More rumblings from the press, more camera flashes. The kids around me had been trained too well to react outwardly beyond startled gasps of their own or quick, covert glances at each other. The majority of them just sat there in disbelief.
"For years, Lillian has stayed out of the public eye so as to conduct research on this exact subject. It has remained confidential only to avoid interference from the former terrorist group, the Children's League, and other domestic enemies. While we are continuing to seek out the cause of this tragic affliction, please rest assured that all children will be able to undergo this life-saving operation. Detailed information about the procedure is being distributed to you now."
A few reporters tried to leap in with questions, shouting Lillian's name, trying, I guess, to coax her to the microphone. Instead, she found a patch of carpet to stare at. Whoever had dolled her up had also managed to vacuum the life out of her.
"As you'll see from the footage and reports we've included, our own son, Clancy, was the first to receive this procedure."
A wave of dizziness passed over me as another form was walked out onto the stage beside them by a man in a dark suit. His head had been shaved and covered with a baseball hat decorated with the presidential seal. He kept his face turned down and out of sight, denying the cameras in front of him a shot until the president leaned away from the microphone and said something to him. His shoulders hunched, Clancy finally lifted his head. He reminded me of a horse on the ground, leg broken under it, never able to stand again, let alone run. With all of the terrible things he'd done, and all of the terrible things I had imagined doing to him, never had this come to mind. I was shocked by the swell of emotions that rose in me, all of them too close, too wild for me to distinguish one from another. I felt sick. He trembled, looking smaller by the moment as his parents kept their smiles plastered on their faces, giving the reporters what they wanted, a family portrait. How perfectly, I thought, have these people drawn Clancy into his own worst nightmare.
You'll remember that he came out of the camp rehabilitation program several years ago. Unfortunately, like with any disease, there are relapses. And this is one of the reasons why we have not felt comfortable releasing the children from these camps. We needed a more permanent solution, and we believe we have found it. There will be more information to come in regards to a timeline of when the procedure will start being performed and a likely end date for the camp rehabilitation program.
I ask you, knowing already how much you've sacrificed and suffered these long years, for more patience, for understanding, for your belief in the future we're about to enter, one that will see the reemergence of our prosperity and way of life.
Thank you, and God bless the United States of America.
Before the first avalanche of questions could sweep up and knock him off his feet, President Gray hooked his arm around Lillian's shoulders, gave a friendly wave to the cameras, and guided her off the stage and out of the room before she could get a single word in. The video ended, frozen on that last image. I felt trapped in that moment, too. No, I thought. Remember why you came here. Now. Do it now. Our PSF escort signaled for us to stand and begin reforming our line to receive our meals, her face creased with impatience. The surprise video had put me off my original plan, but it was easy enough to pick up the pieces and reassemble them in working order. We were near the kitchen, shuffling forward, when I felt the eyes of the PSF on me. I shoved Sam, knocking her to the ground, and if that wasn't enough to dry up every small sound around us, me shouting, "Shut up! Just shut up!" to her did. My voice whipped through the silence, landing like a blow across her confused face. "Play along," I begged, flashing her a look. "Please." A small nod. She understood. I lifted my arm, as if to strike her, ignoring the way Vanessa tried to catch my wrist to prevent it. The hardest thing was not reacting to our PSF as she came toward me, crossing the distance between us in furious strides. This was more than enough to get me punished. More than enough to get me ejected from dinner. The girls around us kept their heads down, but their fear and confusion polluted the air around me as the woman caught me by the collar and hauled me away. Orion and the other camp controllers disassembling the projector and screen didn't even look up at the scuffle. I didn't have to suggest anything to the PSF to get her to drag me into the kitchen. The blue kids scrubbing the pots and pans under blistering water jumped. Several that were sorting the ingredients for the next day's meals turned, momentarily distracted from their work. I searched the ceiling for the black cameras, counting them off as I went. 2, 3. One above the serving window, one near the large pantry, another over the long stainless steel work table, where several of the kids were peeling the potatoes we'd only just pulled from the garden. The back of the mess hall faced the forest, providing maybe 10 feet of walking space between the building and the fence. The cameras never recorded what happened there, but only pointed out into the woods. It was one of the blind spots we'd learned to be afraid of very quickly. She pushed the back door open with her shoulder, and I had a second to react. I yanked the PSF around, twisting her arm behind her to the point of snapping the bone. She let out a choked noise of surprise that cut off sharply as I entered her mind. She unfastened her uniform, ripping off her boots, the black camo shirt and pants, the belt, the dark cap, and let them fall to the ground. I kicked off my tennis shoes, trying to match the frenzied pace I'd set in her mind. She took my uniform, as I passed it to her, tugging it on with a look of blank obedience. Too calm. I floated the image of her as a young child, standing at the heart of the camp, soldiers moving around her, closing in. I only eased up when she started to cry. The flash drive fell out of my shoe into the frostbitten grass, and I quickly palmed it, squeezing it tight to reassure myself it was really there. The swap had taken no more than 2 minutes. 2 minutes too long, maybe. I couldn't tell. The PSFs were allowed to walk us into dark, unmonitored corners, rough us up a little bit before actually carrying out the punishment. If those missing moments had played that way to the camp controllers watching in the control tower, I'd be fine. I walked the PSF toward the garden, my breath fogging the air white with each sharp exhale. I kept my eyes on the thin chains hooked around one of the fence posts. I wanted to say I was a good enough person not to feel some satisfaction as I sat the PSF down in the cold mud and locked her into place facing the fence, her back to the cameras on the nearby cabins and the soldiers patrolling the platform on the tower. I wasn't. After watching so many kids left out for hours on end, simply for talking back or looking at them sideways on a bad day, I wanted at least one of them to know what it felt like. I wanted one of them to see what they had done to Sam each time they brought her out here. It wasn't until I was walking back, passing the red vests posted along the path to the control tower and mess hall, that the first touch of nerves found me. Somehow, as I came closer to it, the brick tower had grown to be twice its original size. Its crooked walls seemed to lean even more sharply up close. "This is an op," I reminded myself. "This is no different than any other op. I would finish it and go home." The PSF stationed next to the control tower's door peered at me through the darkness. Searchlights from the watch platform above crisscrossed in front of me, sweeping around the camp into the dark pockets where other lights couldn't reach.
"Houghton, that you?"
I nodded, adjusting my cap down lower over my eyes, one hand straying to the rifle I'd slung over my shoulder.
"What's..."
His mind unfurled in spirals of green and white and red. I needed him to tap his security badge against the black pad behind him, so he did. I needed him to step aside, so he did. He did everything I asked, even holding the door open for me as I stepped inside. I crossed the threshold into the warm heart of the camp. The heat from the vents sank through the layers of borrowed clothes, straight to my skin and bones. As I looked down the hall, toward the stairs leading up to the platform 2 stories overhead, I don't know when I had ever felt so powerful in my life. The door to my right opened, and a camp controller came out, holding a mug of coffee between his hands. The room behind him disappeared as the door slowly swung shut, but not before I saw the TV, the couches and chairs. His black button-down shirt wrinkled as he brought a hand up to yawn. The look he gave me was a friendly, "What can you do?" Half embarrassed, half unapologetic. Like the whole thing was one big joke. I smiled, letting him pass by to get to the door propped open a short ways down the hall. After a beat, I followed. The left half of the building's lower level was little more than an enormous monitoring station. Screens large and small lined the far wall, each showing a different angle of the camp. One was simply set to a satellite image of the weather. One showed a news channel on mute. There were 3 rows of computers in total, though only half of the seats seemed to be occupied. It looked as though they were starting to pack this room up as well, working from left to right, slowly removing the non-essential stations. This is why they needed the Reds, I thought. The draft was up for so many PSFs, and the ones that remained, along with the newer recruits, were tasked with moving the files and supplies in advance of the camp's closure. Focus. I stepped down to the 2nd row, sliding into the seat. The monitor flickered to life, waking up to reveal a basic desktop. Blood pounded in my ears, but my hands were surprisingly steady as I inserted the flash drive. The folder opened, and I transferred the program file over onto the desktop. I thought I'd misread it at first, my mind half-consumed with anxiety, but Jude.exe transferred quickly and appeared on the screen's black background next to the trash icon, just below a black triangular outline labeled Security. When it finished, I erased the original file from the flash drive and dropped it to the floor, crushing the plastic shell under the heel of my left boot. The clock on the lower right-hand corner of the screen read 19:20. I opened the command prompt window, typed start jude.exe, and the icon disappeared from the desktop. Nothing else happened. Shit, I thought, glancing at the small clock again. Was that right? Why would... The blow cracked against the back of my skull so hard I was thrown halfway off the seat, caught at the last second by a hand that wrenched me back and slammed me against the table, hand at my throat, gun in my face.
Here!
The PSF's face split into two. I blinked, trying to clear my vision as more shapes flooded in through the open door.
Here!
I was pulled off the desk and shoved onto the floor, the pistol inches from my forehead, to make room for a camp controller to take my seat and begin typing. Someone had finally noticed something then. It was over. But I'd done what I needed to. I'd gotten this far. I'd done this, at least. The others in the room stood, alarmed, but backed off when Orion's familiar voice barked,
"Stay clear."
He typed something else, opened the command prompt window.
"What did you do?"
he snarled. I focused on his face, ignoring the warm trickle down the back of my neck. My line of sight solidified again, and I shrugged, a smirk working its way onto my lips. Orion pushed the other soldier away, back into the ring of PSFs and camp controllers who stood nearby with their weapons drawn. My teeth clacked as he threw me back up against the wall, demanding,
"What is your purpose here?"
I wiped the blood from the corner of my mouth and said nothing. There wasn't a damn thing he could do to me now that could make me feel afraid or small or helpless. The camp controller turned back to another woman sitting nearby.
"Key up the calm control."
"Group C is still in the mess hall," she said. "Should they be ordered back to their cabins first?"
"Key it up."
She turned back to her screen and typed furiously, ending with a stroke of her pinky against the return key.
"Wait."
One by one, the monitors on the wall winked out. Then each computer screen, the images blacking out with a sinister electronic hiss.
"Start the fail-safe protocol," he said.
"Sir?" she said, startled, but tried. She tried.
"I'm locked out."
"Of what?"
"Everything."
"Me too." "Same."
I knew it was pointless, even as I got my feet under me, but I didn't want to admit it. I wasn't done. I wasn't ready for it to be over. The guns around me were a dozen different ways to die. I was boxed in on all sides by black uniforms. My ears rang and the ground rolled beneath my feet, but I let the invisible hands in my mind go streaming out to the minds around me. I sent them sailing in every direction like arrows seeking targets. Orion pulled his arm back and punched me in the face. I couldn't get my hands up fast enough to block him, couldn't get them down fast enough to catch me. I slammed into the ground, my vision bursting with static as my skull cracked against the tile. He leaned over me, unclipping a small device from his belt, holding it next to my right ear. I spit in his face, and he only laughed, switching on the white noise. The world shattered around me. Hands seized my arms and hauled me up from the ground, dragging me through the tangle of legs and chairs. I couldn't see straight, couldn't clear my brain from the sounds polluting it. Every muscle in my body was seizing up, making me jerk, my feet thrash against the floor, and inside I was screaming. I was screaming, "I'm not done!" But I couldn't hear myself think.
The white noise took me by the shoulders and shoved me down beneath the darkness, holding me there until I drowned. 26. The slap whipped across my face, ripping away the shroud of unconsciousness. My vision blurred as my eyes flew open, squinting against the light. My mind felt swollen and tender, as wrung out as the rest of my body. I was half conscious of the fact that my arms and legs were still spasming, the muscles twitching. The residual pain left me dumb and slow, and I couldn't remember why, how it had happened. The noise blistering my mind shut off abruptly. Slowly, slowly, the room solidified around me. Tile floor, 4 dark walls, 1 lamp, 2 figures in black moving in and out of the shadows, speaking in low tones. I heard a faint metallic clicking as one of them came closer. I smelled the mint as he smacked his gum. Little bitch. And just like that, memory slammed into me. Tower. Out. Run. I twisted, trying to pull out of the chair they'd put me in, but my hands and ankles were zip-tied to the metal frame. The jolt of fear-induced adrenaline cleared my mind just in time for Orion to backhand me.
Now that we have your attention, he snarled, rising to his feet.
Cold air bit into my shin, and I looked down to find that he'd rolled both of my pant legs up to the knee. They'd stripped the PSF uniform jacket off me, taking the knife, the weapons, anything I could have used to fight back. The boots, too, though I didn't understand why. Not until Orion motioned for the baton the PSF behind him carried. The other man took that as his signal to hold up the handheld white noise machine. I reared like a wild horse, trying to escape it, the way it blanked out my mind.
What could I do? What?
Who sent you? Orion asked. What was your purpose here?
To tell you?
The words didn't sound nearly as furious coming out of my mouth as they did in my head. The camp controller leaned forward, eyes narrowing into slits.
To go fuck yourself.
The white noise came on, louder, higher, a bullet that slammed through my temples. I couldn't keep the cry in. Sweat streamed down my back, my chest. It became a pattern. On, agony, off, pain. On, agony, off, pain. I couldn't catch my breath. I had to fight to keep the sweet nothing of unconsciousness away. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't leave this moment. They would kill me. I wouldn't be able to. I wouldn't be able to.
Who sent you?
Fuck you!
I shouted right back in his face. I braced myself as he swung his arm back, but it did nothing. Nothing to prepare me for the explosion of white-hot agony that rocketed through me as his baton struck my exposed shin. I screamed, jerking against the restraints. I heard the crack, felt it inside of my head like it was my skull splitting apart. The PSF behind the camp controller only watched impassively as Orion struck the broken bone again, smiling as I vomited onto the floor. He swung again, stopping just short of my leg, a mocking smile on his face. He gave a silent wave of his hand toward the PSF, who reached for the white noise device again.
Not the Children's League, Orion said over the hurricane of sound shredding my overloaded nerves. It couldn't be them. So who?
I heard the echo of it even when it was switched off, white spots sparking behind my eyelids.
Answer me, 3285.
He leaned over my face, thrusting the mangled flash drive in front of it.
What was on this? Tell me, and I promise that you'll live.
I want to live. Orion gripped my chin in his hand.
3285. You should know I have no qualms about putting your kind down.
My kind. Orange. I sucked in a sharp breath, licking the blood that had run from my nose over my busted lip. Orange.
He turned back toward the PSF, motioning him forward. My leg was demanding my attention, burning up my concentration. But my eyes slid over to the younger man, and I reached. I reached.
Orion held up the white noise device in one hand, his service pistol in the other.
Which would you prefer?
I have to walk out of here.
The gun came up in his hand, sliding up my throat, under my chin. The white noise device rubbed along the edge of my ear.
It would give me no greater pleasure than to see your brain scrambled and leaking from your ears, splattered against this floor. Tell me why you're here, 3285, and I'll stop this. It'll all be over.
I want to live.
The building shook, throwing him back a step and rattling both the nearby table and the simple light fixture hanging over us, the pop and snarl of distant gunfire. A strange, sweet symphony of hope. Footsteps pounded down the hall, heading out toward the exit. Orion shoved himself away from me and went to the one-way window lining the wall, cupping his hands against it to try to see through it. He knocked against the mirrored surface, waiting. My line of sight was shrinking again, heading into black. The door in the corner, the one we'd come in through, had no handle. It could only be opened from the outside. I closed my eyes, tightening my fists against a second wave of nausea. I want to live. I want to live. I have to live.
Ruby,
I croaked out. Orion turned slowly.
What was that, 3285? You ready to talk now?
My name, I said between clenched teeth, is
Ruby.
I overturned my chair, knocking myself over onto the ground, and an aftershock of pain lanced up my leg. I played the scene out in my mind and heard the reality on a half-second delay. The PSF in the corner of the room lifted his gun and fired three times, missing Orion on the first shot and shattering a section of the glass behind him, but hitting his mark on the second and third attempt. Chest, head. Orion got one shot off, hitting the PSF's throat before slumping down against the wall beneath the one-way window. I must have passed out. For a few seconds, maybe minutes, the control tower was eerily silent, and the only sound I heard as I surfaced back to reality was my own heart's slow, steady beat.
Move,
I ordered myself. Move, Ruby, move. My progress across the floor to Orion's body was slow and agonizing. I needed the knife on his belt to cut the ties on my feet and hands, but it meant dragging the chair through the puddle of congealing blood beneath him. I sawed frantically, nicking my palms as I worked the knife blindly behind me. I sucked in a harsh breath and looked down. The strange, tented skin on my shin made me gag, the sight reminding my body all over again that it was in pain. I hopped and hobbled over to the door, but I'd been right. There was no handle, and the hinges were on the other side. I picked up Orion's pistol and positioned myself against the opposite wall, using it as a brace for the gun's recoil. The reverberations raced up my arms and shoulders as the glass shards fell in waves. I switched the safety back on and went to work knocking the remaining pieces out of the window frame. Bracing my hands on the ledge, I dragged myself up and over it. The jagged teeth caught and tore at my arms and legs as I collapsed into the hallway. The gun flew out of my hands. I reached for it through the halo of glass around me. My fingers closed around the grip, just as the squeak of rubber against the tile reached my ears. I rolled onto my back, lifting my torso up just enough to aim at the dark figure running toward me. I fumbled with the safety, switching it off. The barrage of gunfire outside heated my blood, focusing me in the moment. I saw the black uniform, and my finger curled around the trigger. I was getting out of here.
I was getting out. Don't shoot!
The power snapped off, throwing the building into darkness, but I'd seen his face as he pulled up his helmet. I thought at first that I was seeing a ghost, and somehow the reality was almost more impossible. Liam.
Stop doing that! I cried, dropping my gun in terror. I almost killed you!
His face was so thin, practically worn down to the bone. He rushed toward me, dropping to his knees and sliding the last bit of distance between us. His hands were everywhere at once, and he was kissing me, lips, cheeks, forehead, wherever he could reach, and I was breathing him in, clinging to his sopping wet shirt, unable to process the simple fact that he was here, that he was okay. He shifted, jarring my leg, and I couldn't keep the scream from escaping my throat.
Shit! Shit, I'm sorry, Jesus!
Liam fumbled for the radio, clipped to his jacket.
I found her! Dad, I need your help!
It almost happened too quickly. Footsteps pounded against the ground behind me, and when Liam looked up, it was as if his helpless anger solidified, grew teeth. He reached for the gun in the holster strapped to his leg, and a shudder ripped through me. I recognized the darkness in his expression I'd seen all too many times in his brother. My hand flew out, slamming down on his, keeping his weapon in place. Not Liam. Not now. Not ever. He wasn't a killer. Losing himself in a single moment would fracture him at his core. It would be a bone that healed crookedly inside him until it changed his shape. I saw the moment he came back to himself, the way his nostrils flared and his eyes cleared. When he looked up at the PSF running toward us again, this time he threw a hand out, sending the soldier crashing back into the nearest wall, knocking him out cold. He released a shuddering breath as he looked down at me again. Gently, with a level of care that seemed at odds with his actions only a second ago, he inspected the cuts on my arms and swore. I was trembling, but he must have mistaken the pain for cold because he ripped his jacket off and drew it around me, zipping it up my throat to trap the warmth inside. I bit back the sob welling in my chest.
Why did it have to be you?
He demanded.
Why did it have to be you?
Sorry, I whispered. For Cole. For making him come here. For everything. In case the darkness came back and I couldn't say it then.
Sorry. Love you. Love you so much.
Liam kissed me again.
Can we get the hell out of here now?
Another figure in black appeared at the head of the stairs, his shoulders heaving as he caught his breath. I scrambled for my gun, but Liam gripped my hand.
Over here!
I saw a flash of black skin, a handsome, grizzled face as he rushed toward us.
Is she all right?
Not really, Liam said, leaning back so his stepfather could see my leg. To me, he insisted,
But you're going to be fine, you hear me? Ouch, darling.
Harry said, crouching down to examine it.
We're going to get you out of here, all right?
I have to walk out of here,
I told him, mind fogging over with the pain.
I have to walk out of here. My own feet.
He exchanged a tense look with Liam.
We need something to brace it with,
Liam started, looking around.
There's no time for that, Harry said. They'll have medics at the meet point.
I have to walk out.
I didn't care how crazy it made me sound. They needed to understand. Cole would understand.
Would have understood.
Cole was past tense now. I squeezed my eyes shut. When I opened them again, Harry reached over to a radio clipped onto his left shoulder.
This is Stuart. We have her. Proceeding to exit. ETA 3 minutes.
There was a flurry of static responses.
Okay, darling, I'm gonna get you up,
Liam said, rising to his feet.
Put your arms around my shoulders. That's right. Just like that.
True to their word, Once they had me up, they adjusted me so I could stand on my good leg. I don't remember the hallway as it passed us, only how it felt each time my right leg swung forward, the frigid air on my skin as we stepped out into the night, the first touch of rain. I smelled smoke. The air hung heavy with it. Up ahead, there was a river of green and blue moving out of the camp's front gate. The kids walked quickly, waved on by figures in black, their white bands stark against their sleeves. I was proud of how calm they were, the way they listened to the instructions they were given, even half terrified or in shock. Thurmond, at least, had trained them to do that much. "Reds," I tried to say. I saw the warm glow of a fire at the far end of the camp, where the factory was burning.
"They're secured," Harry said, giving the hand I'd hooked around his neck a gentle squeeze. "Put up one hell of a fight."
"Hurt?"
"Everyone's okay," he promised.
He let out a sharp whistle, and the nearest figure in black turned around expectantly and ran toward us. She moved with a kind of animal grace, arms pumping at her side, boots spraying mud everywhere as she trampled through the puddles and thick black mud. I couldn't see her face through the curtain of rain, but I knew. Vida. She would have crashed into us if Harry hadn't put out a strong hand to catch her.
"Careful,"
Liam warned, drawing me closer to his side as Harry pulled back and untangled his grip. Vida filled in the spot he'd vacated, wrapping both arms around me.
"Holy shit," she said. "I'm going to kill you. I'm actually going to wring your little neck. I'm going to...
"I'm going to sweep through the mess one last time to check for stragglers," Harry said. "Mac, John, and I will bring up the rear."
"See you at the meet point," Liam said.
"Ruby, let me carry you, please."
"I have to walk."
My throat ached, the words coming out in a croak.
"Can you help me?"
He had already started to adjust his grip when Vida stopped him by taking the other half of my weight.
"Whatever you want, as long as it means getting you out of this goddamn nightmare factory. I mean, holy shit, boo!"
Our progress was slow and awkward through the mud, but we staggered forward, drifting into the rush of kids moving out, heading toward the gate that was blown wide open. It rained the day they brought us to Thurmond, and it rained the day I walked out. I knew I was in trouble when I couldn't shake the cold, couldn't stop trembling. As we walked through the woods, following the kids ahead of us, the black uniforms with white bands at the front, my shivering made my muscles lock and limbs seize. Vida glanced over at Liam, and our pace quickened.
"Hurts,"
I whispered.
"Do you want to stop? Rest?"
Vida asked.
"Is it your leg?"
I shook my head.
"Everything."
To fill the silence, or to distract me, Liam tried to explain what had happened.
"Mom gave me the number to contact Harry, to tell him about Cole. She told me how to find him. They waited for me, and by then I knew I should have gone straight back, that I wanted to. But by the time we made it to the ranch, you were long gone. Chubbs was beside himself, so was Zoo, all of them. Nico held it together for them until we got back."
"Fucking Clancy," Vida said. "Fucking crazy-ass Grays. They did this broadcast, him and his mom."
"I saw,"
I said, not willing or particularly able to go into detail at that moment.
"How did you..." "Never mind, it doesn't matter,"
Liam said.
"You tell me later, when this is over and done with."
"Cole,"
I started to say, my grip on him tightening. His face twisted with fresh grief.
"Later, okay? It's not too much farther. We had to set the meet point nearby. Too many kids to drive out. I wish you could have seen it. Amplify pushed the information we gave them out everywhere. TV, the internet, traffic signs. They bombarded the world with the truth."
"Let's see if it actually worked," Vida muttered. "If there aren't any parents waiting..."
"They'll be waiting,"
Liam insisted. No matter how many steps I took,
It still felt like we were falling farther and farther away from the lights filtering through the trees. I knew he was right, though, when the first helicopter appeared over us, casting a light down and kicking up the wind and rain. It was blinding. I couldn't tell if it belonged to the military or to the news. There had been a din of noise, this faint, low buzz of energy and sound I'd barely been able to detect under the shrill ringing in my ears. Now it was like I could hear the pulse of the world around me, throbbing underfoot. Up ahead, there were more lights, all pointed toward us. The assault team, kids and adults alike, brought the huge group up short, just past the line of trees. There were buildings nearby, most likely the abandoned downtown area of Thurmond, West Virginia. Liam and Vida navigated us up through the sea of stalled bodies, shouldering our way closer to the front. 3,000 children spread out through the trees like an avalanche, stopping up every gap between them. I knew when we were close because someone got on a bullhorn and barked out,
"Remain where you are. Any advancement will be seen as a sign of hostile aggression."
But if the armed forces saw us, so did the families gathered behind them. We were moving forward again, slowly now, but at a steady pace. Finally, through the blinding field ahead of us, shapes began to form. 2 large white tents had been set up by someone. Lights from ambulances and cop cars flashed blue, red, blue, falling over us and the double lines of soldiers that stood between us and hundreds, if not thousands, of people. I blinked, trying to clear my thoughts. This was right. This was how it was supposed to be. Alice would have released her last blast of information during the assault, including the names of the children at Thurmond and a location where they could be retrieved. I'd assumed that it would also give the military time to respond, and I'd been right. The soldiers, National Guard, police, and PSFs alike had assumed a defensive stance, shielded by riot gear.
"Drop your weapons! Get down on the ground and place your hands on your head," the same man ordered. "Any further advancement will be seen as a sign of hostile aggression, and we will open fire."
We kept moving forward, toward the men and women in camouflage, toward the few in black PSF uniforms, until we were less than 300 feet away. The tall, clear riot shields formed an actual wall between us, but didn't mask the way the soldiers' eyes flickered over us. The row behind them was armed and primed to do exactly as the officer had threatened. The muzzles of their guns were carefully placed in the gaps of space between the shields. They stood back to back with a row of FBI and uniformed police officers who were facing the crowd of reporters and civilians. Cameras. There were cameras everywhere, flashing, recording, even as the men and women tried to block the shots or smash the devices altogether. The helicopter's propeller announced its arrival long before it appeared in the sky. Its searchlight swept over us several times, as if scanning for one person in particular. A soldier sat at the edge of the open door, an automatic rifle in his hands, as he took stock of the situation. The officer in charge stood just left of center, behind both lines of soldiers. There was a satellite phone pressed to his ear. He kept ducking in and out of sight, as if crouching down could somehow drown out the noise of the crowd that rose behind him, breaking over all of us in a rush. Names, I thought, forcing myself to look beyond the weapons and the gear, to the faces of regret and hope behind them. One of the kids behind me recognized one of them, clearly, because she surged forward with a shout of, "Mom! Mom!"
"Get down on the ground and put your hands behind your head," the officer yelled into the bullhorn. "Do it now! Now!"
"Here!" a woman shouted back. "I'm here! Emily! I'm here!"
Watching the face of the soldier directly in front of me was like seeing a trickling creek become a river. Emotion roared across his eyes,
and not even the glare of the chopper's searchlight could disguise the look he cast back at the woman, who was struggling against the three FBI agents pushing her to the ground. The civilians around her pushed back, trying to drive them away from her. The soldier was well past the point of youth. The stubble on his weathered cheeks was silver, matching the heavy brows above his pale blue eyes. He faced forward again, ignoring the uncomfortable shifting of the younger men and women to his left and right as they waited for their next order. His gaze shifted to a girl a few feet away from me. She was crying, still yelling, "Mom! Mom!" Her dark curls stuck to her wet cheeks. The soldier shook his head. Such a slow, simple movement. He shook his head and let the riot shield fall forward into the mud. The sound somehow cut off all others. His own automatic rifle he left on the ground as he straightened up to his full height, chest out and forward, as he dodged the hand of the dumbstruck soldier next to him who'd half-heartedly put an arm out to stop him. He stepped over his own shield, snapping the clips on his Kevlar vest and tugging it off. The helicopter's light found his path and traced it as he came toward us slowly, showing that he was unarmed. He held out his hand to her, and, after a moment of hesitation, she took it and allowed him to draw her forward to drop the vest over her head. His helmet came off next, and though it was too big for her, he clipped it on anyway, adjusting the strap tight under her chin. The soldier picked her up, and she locked her arms around his neck in complete trust. As he carried her back toward the line of soldiers, the officer in charge finally shook off his stupor enough to realize he should be shouting orders. He tried. No one, not a single one of us, listened. I heard my heart in my ears, louder and louder, and held my breath. Holding out an arm, he pushed his way through the soldiers that tried to close the gap he'd left in the line, until finally, the few FBI agents still standing over the woman released her. She met the soldier halfway, tearing the girl out of his arms and into hers. It wasn't until Liam reached up and lightly squeezed the arm I had around his neck that I realized the kids around me were moving again. The crack in the line of soldiers expanded as two kids followed the path they had taken through. Three kids. Four. The officer was shouting into the megaphone, but except for a rare few, the soldiers were lifting their riot shields out of formation and turning to the side. The kids flooded through them, the same way they'd flowed through the trees, finding the openings, gathering their courage close, and passing through them. Vida said something I couldn't hear. My head was too heavy now for my neck to support, and both of them stumbled as my left leg crumpled beneath me. Liam's hands were on my face, forcing my eyes open. It was so cold. How could I be sweating? I was lifted up completely, carried through the crush of families. More than one had thought to make signs with their child's name, using those strange, unthinkable phrases like, "Welcome home," and "We love you." When my eyes opened again, the next face I saw was Chubbs's. The word on his lips was shock. And Kate. There was Kate. Her cheek bruised, tears in her eyes. She held my face between her hands and was talking to me as I was lifted off the ground. The red, blue, white lights stained their skin. I knew we were running, but I couldn't feel anything, even as I was lifted again, higher this time, onto a soft surface. Unfamiliar faces, lights flashing, snapping sounds, voices. Liam. Ambulance. Liam tried to climb into the back with me, but he was forced out as two of the assault team members were loaded on. Two men, one clutching an unnaturally limp arm, the other bleeding profusely at the brow.
"I'll come find you,"
Liam was shouting as he backed out.
"We'll find you."
The EMTs strapped me down, pushing me back onto the stretcher. Liam stood a few feet away and Chubbs had his arms around him, trying to talk him down, hold him in place. He saw the panic surging in him clearly as I had. The door slammed shut, and the siren switched on.
Tell me your name. Can you tell me your name?
The EMT was a young woman, her expression serious, as she studied me.
We have a possible transverse fracture of the right tibia. 4, 5, 6 lacerations, ranging from 4 centimeters to 6 on the upper and lower body.
Look at me.
Can you tell me your name? Can you speak?
I shook my head, tongue like stone.
Are you in pain?
I nodded.
Blood pressure low, rapid pulse, hypovolemic shock. Can you...
One of the men on the floor was blocking the drawer she needed to get into, but pried it open with his good arm, passing her what looked like a large sheet of tinfoil. The EMT spread it over me as another put a line in my arm and began bandaging. The strange blanket trapped in a little pocket of warmth. I began to tremble as the pain woke up again.
What happened to your leg?
I grunted as she lifted it into some kind of brace.
Can you tell me what happened to your leg?
Hurts, I choked out. She held my face between her hands, and I felt wild, almost unhinged, as I looked into her eyes.
You're okay. You're safe. We're going to take care of you. You're safe.
One of the soldiers on the floor reached up, his blood-stained hand coming to rest softly over my wrist.
You're a good girl.
He said,
"You're a good, brave girl. You did a good job."
"You're safe now," the EMT repeated. "We're going to take care of you." The wall I'd built up against the well of pain and fear and anger finally collapsed, and I began to cry. I sobbed, the way I had in the garage of my parents' house on that last morning before they took me. I bawled because it was such a relief not to have to hold it in any longer, to have to pretend. I didn't have to stay awake when the first pull of peaceful nothing came. 27. For days, I felt like I was trapped inside my own body. There were moments, few and far between, where I could sense I was waking up, coming close to the surface of reality. Unfamiliar sounds, clicking, wheezing, beeps, faces behind blue paper masks, ceilings passing overhead. I had the most vivid dreams of my life, haunted by people I hadn't seen in years. I rode in the front seat of a black van, my forehead against the glass. I saw the ocean, the trees, the sky. In the same way that the earth always hardens again after the rain, I felt myself solidify again, becoming a whole made of pieces, and one morning, I simply woke up to a room full of sunshine. I blinked, body and head heavy and slow, as I turned toward the source of the light. A window, the curtains framing the flowering arm of a nearby dogwood tree. The walls were painted a soothing light blue, a strange contrast to the dark gray machinery beeping and glowing around me. Hospital. I dragged myself up, meeting the resistance of the wires attached to the back of my hand with a few gentle tugs. Someone had draped a thin white sheet over me, and I had to use my left leg to kick it off in order to inspect the new, unexpected weight around the right. A plaster cast. A long flannel pajama shirt. Beneath it, my arms were heavily bandaged, and I felt the pull of tape along my collarbone. I reached up to feel the gauze padding. I let myself relax, listening just for a moment to the sound of the street below, the stream of voices on the other side of the wall. Some part of me knew that I should be afraid, but I was too exhausted to try. When I couldn't stand the sour, dry feeling of my mouth and throat any longer, I reached for the water glass on the stand nearby and downed it in one go, nearly knocking over a small vase of flowers. There were crutches leaning against the opposite wall, under a TV mounted from the ceiling. But the moment I started to swing my feet over the side of the bed, the door cracked open. I don't know who was more surprised, Me or the petite, steel-haired woman who stepped inside with a small tray of food? Green eyes widened.
You're awake.
She shut the door quickly behind her, then turned back to me, absolutely glowing. I stared at her, devouring the sight. She mistook my silence for distress, or confusion, I thought, because she quickly set the tray down and dragged a nearby chair over.
Do you know who I am?
The word burst out of me. Grams! She grinned, taking my hand and holding it between her soft, paper-thin skin. For a long time, we did nothing but study each other. Her face was softer now, and she'd let her dark hair lighten completely. But there was this look of mischief in her eyes that was so uniquely hers, I felt myself choke up at the sight.
You've seen some trouble, haven't you?
I nodded, and she leaned over and kissed my forehead.
You're here, I repeated, somehow dumbfounded by this. You found me.
Little girl, after they took you, we never stopped looking for you. The moment they released the list of children and the location of the camp, we were in the car speeding straight for you. It took us hours to find out which hospital you were in. You had quite the crowd guarding you. They almost didn't let me and your folks in.
I shook my head, unable to process this. They don't remember me.
No, they don't. It's very odd, but they... How do I say it? They can't drum up the details, but you've always been there, deep down. Not here, she said, tapping her forehead.
She moved her hand down to cover her chest.
Here.
I almost couldn't get the words out.
Do you know what I am?
Well, for starters, you're my darling, precious girl who can do something a little peculiar with her mind, she said,
her soft southern accent stronger than ever.
You also seem to be somewhat of a media darling.
I sat back at that, suspicion working a slow path through my mind. Grams held up a finger, walking over to retrieve a newspaper from a purse I hadn't noticed by the door.
It's been a feeding frenzy outside of the hospital for days. You have two armed guards posted outside of your room at all times, a whole wing to yourself, and still a vulture tried to sneak in and take a photo of you.
The New York Times had run with the news of the camp hit and the subsequent fallout. I spread the newspaper out over my lap, apprehension already cutting through my hard-won calm. In the time I'd been gone, Alice's original idea for an information package had changed, blossoming into the complete story of what had happened in Los Angeles and at the ranch. It was pages of her photographs of us, all of us, planning, playing, working. The road code. She'd written about why the deceptions had been necessary and what editors and media bosses had worked with us to cover up the truth until the Thurmond camp hit began. There was a long profile of Cole, his face grinning up at me in black and white. And then there was the piece about me. While she hadn't gone into any details about my abilities, Alice had deprived readers of pretty much nothing else. I was at the edge of many of her photos, just out of frame, face hidden by shadows or hair. The others, Kate especially, must have filled her in on how I'd escaped Thurmond in the first place, what my life had been like on the run and with the League, and then how I'd been willing to go back to the camp to help them. The paper had run photos of me being carried to the ambulance, but Liam's face was out of the shot. It might as well have been a completely different person because I didn't recognize that small, pale girl at all. I shrank back against the pillow, feeling exposed under Graham's watchful eye.
There's more, if you'd like to read it, she said, taking the paper away.
Not now, I said.
Has anyone else...
Grams walked the paper back across the room and took up her tray of hospital food again, settling it over me.
Has anyone else what?
Been by, I mumbled. To visit,
Grams gave me a knowing smile. A charming young woman with a mouth that could give a sailor a heart attack? A sweet little one who brought you flowers? The one who spent half a day chasing doctors and nurses around, demanding answers about your condition? Or, by any chance, are you referring to a very well-mannered southern boy?
All of them, I whispered. Are they here?
Not at the moment, Graham said. They had to go back to the hotel. Everyone's in Charleston for this fancy press conference. But they were here, and they asked me to give you this for when you woke up, so you know how to find them.
Grams handed me a folded piece of paper, hotel stationery, as it turned out, with a telephone number scrawled across it.
Call as soon as you can.
Liam's handwriting.
I missed you very much, darling girl,
Graham said softly. One day I hope you'll talk to me about what's happened to you. I don't want to read about it. I'd much rather hear it from you.
I missed you too, I whispered. So, so much. I wanted to find you.
She smoothed the hair back from my face.
Do you want to see them now?
I didn't need any clarification about who them meant.
Do they...
I swallowed. Do they want to see me?
Oh, yes, Graham said, as long as it's all right with you.
After a moment, I nodded. When she left the room, I balanced my tray on the small table. My heart was hammering in my chest the moment I heard their footsteps.
The last time, I thought. This is the last time I'll do this.
Grams appeared first, stepping aside to let a slight, frail woman in, followed closely by a salt-and-pepper-haired man. It was remarkable how little I remembered about what they really looked like. Maybe the years had done damage to them the way they had to me, thinning them out, running them back and forth over life's sharp edges. It was so odd to see the shape of my nose on another person's face, my eyes, my mouth, the dimple on my chin. He wore a polo shirt tucked into slacks, she wore a dress, and I had the strange thought that they had dressed up to see me. I wished it didn't feel so painfully uncomfortable, but I could see it in their faces. They looked at me, and all they remembered was the morning I'd been taken away, when they'd forced me out of the house in their confusion. The years stood between us, empty, aching. So I started with the sweetness. A camping trip we had taken a very, very long time ago in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The hike down through the autumn trees, just beginning to change their colors. The air had been crisp and clear, the rolling mountains only a few shades darker than the endless blue sky above. We'd slept together, the three of us, in this little pocket of warmth in our tent, fishing for our food. I'd watched, amazed, as Dad had started the campfire. The knotted memories released with only the slightest touch, as if they'd already begun to unravel on their own. I pulled back from each of their minds in turn, barely able to control my own feelings without the sudden flood of theirs.
"Someone, please say something," Graham said, exasperated.
But I didn't need to say a word. I only needed to let them hold me as they cried. I've heard some people say life can change in a day, completely flipping you feet over head. But they're wrong. Life doesn't need a day to change. It needs three. 3 days for parachutes to start falling from the sky, bringing packages and soldiers in blue United Nations berets into the cities that needed them most. For a small coalition of foreign leaders to step foot on American soil for the first time in 7 years. For Senator Cruz's story to be released, and for her to be chosen to oversee the entire country's restoration process. For the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to resign, shrugging off the shame and collecting his pension. For the armed forces to issue new orders, and to then realize the men and women who'd left their postings were never coming back. For the President of the United States of America to disappear off the face of the earth. For the United Nations to divide the country up into four peacekeeping zones, each overseen by a former senator of that region and a foreign power, and send in troops to oversee the policing. For the first of nearly 100 water riots to occur. For Leda Corp to issue a statement denying their involvement in Agent Ambrosia, but oh so generously offering to supply a chemical they claimed could neutralize it. I read about it in the papers my parents brought in, watched it on the news, absorbed this new reality. And that night, when visiting hours were over and two kind but firm nurses led my family away, I reached over for the phone on the wall. The painkillers they'd given me were making me drowsy, but I didn't want to sleep without hearing his voice, without making sure they were all okay. I dialed the number and lay back down, the phone cradled between my ear and shoulder. I spun the curling phone cord around my fingers, waiting as it rang, and rang, and rang, and rang. They're probably out, doing something. I tried not to let myself deflate as I started to reach over to hang the phone back up. I could try again in the morning. Hello? The voice burst through the connection, breathless. Hello? I drew the phone back and smiled as I whispered, Hi. Liam let out a soft breath.
It's so good to hear your voice. How are you feeling?
Better now.
I'm so sorry we couldn't stay. Senator Cruz asked us to come back to the hotel. There's been... It's no excuse, but it's been busy. Both Chubbs and Vi said that you'd be mad at us if we didn't go.
They were right. I settled back down on my side. What's been going on? Graham said something about a press conference?
Yeah, for the plan. The big plan. It's been a parade of faces coming in and out. Oh, God, and get this. We have a representative in the deliberations.
Who? I asked. If it wasn't Liam, then who?
Guess who opened his big chubsy mouth and started, in glorious detail, outlining every single thing he thought Senator Cruz should be doing the other night at dinner. It was a magnificent rant.
I closed my eyes, laughing. No, really?
Really. She told him that he had to report to the meeting room the next morning. Liam continued. He was either elated or irritated by the honor. Sometimes it's hard to tell with him.
I listened to the sound of him breathing in the silence that followed. Are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah, darling. Everyone's fine.
He said, but there was an obvious strain in his voice.
Mom's getting here tomorrow. She keeps saying that word, too. Fine. I just wish you were here, is all. I'm going to come first thing tomorrow.
No, I said. First thing in the morning, I'm coming to you.
Maybe I'll just have to meet you halfway,
he said, a laugh tucked into the edge of his voice. I listened as he told me about the 100-odd kids who were still waiting to be picked up by their parents. They'd been given free rooms at the hotel, free meals, too, and a veritable army of volunteers had come in with supplies and clothes. He told me about catching Vida and Chubbs getting handsy with each other in the elevator, Zoo's small shrug when she was told her parents had managed to leave the country, and, until they could be contacted, she had a choice— go home and stay with her aunt, uncle, and Hina, or live with Vida, Nico, and Kate near D.C., so the latter could consult with Senator Cruz. How it hadn't even taken her a second to settle on D.C. I told him about my parents, the way the soldiers posted outside of my door peeked in every time it opened, the way the doctor's hands shook just a little as he examined my cuts, and, at some point, I felt myself begin to drift off to sleep.
Hang up. Go to sleep, Liam said, sounding just as tired.
You hang up.
and in the end, neither of us did. The next morning, clear on the other side of town, I sat sandwiched between my parents on a couch in the lobby of a Marriott hotel in Charleston, West Virginia. It was a testament to how packed it was that no one, not a single member of the press, seemed to notice me as we sat there. At about a quarter till, the crowds began to migrate toward the elevators to head up to the large conference room. As we waited, Mom kept insisting I needed something, water, a snack, a book, some Tylenol, until finally Dad reached over and placed a calming hand on her arm. I caught him watching me out of the corner of his eye, though, as if he needed to keep checking I was still there. This was how we were warming to each other, slowly, clumsily, earnestly. Grams paced the floor in front of us, and it was only because she stopped that I knew someone was coming. But it wasn't Liam or Vida. It was Kate. Her pale blonde hair had been smoothed back into a neat ponytail, and she was wearing makeup, a dress. She seemed shadowed, somehow, face drawn in a way that made my heart clench. I flew up to my feet, my dad reaching up to steady me as I rocked forward on my walking cast. Her pace slowed somewhat as she saw me, and I was glad when I saw the smile stretch across her face. If she had started crying, I wouldn't have trusted myself not to.
"I'm so proud of you," she whispered. "You fill me with awe. Thank you."
I hugged her as fiercely as she hugged me, and I was filled to the brim with the warmth of her love. When I finally released her and introduced her to my family, it was clear they were already well aware of who she was. She clasped my hands in hers.
"Can we talk later? I need to run upstairs, but I didn't want to go another minute without seeing for myself that you were okay."
I nodded, letting her draw me into another embrace. Just as I started to pull back, she said, her voice low,
"There's someone here you won't want to see."
I had a feeling I knew exactly who she was talking about, and was grateful she had given me a warning ahead of time to prepare myself. Liam, Vida, Nico, and Zoo got off the elevator that she got on. I couldn't stop the broad grin from spreading across my face. Zoo was the first to reach me, a streak of pink dress cutting through the lobby to wrap her arms around my center. Nico hung back, shifting awkwardly between his feet until I urged him over. Vida had no such qualms. She gave me a hard punch to the shoulder, which I think I was supposed to read as playful. And Liam, well aware of my parents' eyes on him, reintroduced himself to them, shaking their hands. He came toward me slowly, giving me time to get a good read on him. His hair was cut and tamed, and he was clean-shaven. If he was tired, it didn't show, but I saw a shadow of grief in his eyes. When he offered a small, shy smile, I returned it, my heart feeling like it was about to leap out of my chest.
"Hello again, ma'am," he said, perfectly polite, as he shook Graham's hand.
She planted a big one on his cheek and turned to me with a wink. When he reached me, Liam simply took my arm and asked,
"Everyone ready to go up?"
It was stupid to feel a pang of disappointment that I hadn't gotten a proper greeting, but my hands were practically burning with the need to run my hands through his hair, smooth the lines from his face. When the elevator doors slid open, I started forward, but he held us in place, allowing my parents, Zoo, Vida, Nico, and about a half dozen others onto the elevator.
"You know what?"
Liam said, waving my dad off when he reached to hold the doors open.
"We'll get the next one."
And the minute the doors slammed shut, his arm slid around my waist, his other hand wove through my hair, and I was being kissed to within an inch of my life.
"Hi,"
he said when he finally came up for air.
"Hi,"
I said, now both dizzy and breathless as he leaned down to rest his forehead against mine.
"Do we have to go up?"
He nodded, but it was another few moments before he actually reached over and pushed the up button. The press conference had been set up in the hotel's ballroom space,
a room that accommodated 100 chairs, 3/4 of which were already taken by the time we got up there. When I saw that the others had saved us seats at the very back of the room, I almost cried in gratitude. Already I was feeling eyes shift toward me, and the uncomfortable feeling would only have been compounded if we'd been in a position for the whole room to stare at the back of my head, if I couldn't make a clean escape if I needed to. Liam seemed to sense this and guided me forward, a hand on the small of my back, to an aisle seat. No sooner had we found our spots than two men, both in military dress uniforms, moved away from us to the other side of the room. Vida gave them a little toothy smile and wave when they glanced back at us again. The room shushed itself into silence as the first people walked out onto the stage. All were men, some military, some clearly politicians. Those were the ones who remembered to turn and smile for the cameras before sitting down. I released a deep breath as Senator Cruz appeared, followed by Dr. Gray, and then, surprisingly, Kate. Liam's hand found mine as Chubbs walked out, shoulders back, eyes forward. He wore a beautiful navy suit and a striped tie, finishing off the look with new, thin, wire-rimmed glasses. "Nerd," I heard Vida mutter, but she had this pleased little smile on her face. I glanced at Liam and found an expression as grim as mine. It was a fine package Chubbs had wrapped himself in, almost enough to distract me from the look on his face. I'd seen it a dozen times, the chin jutting out, the eyes sullen. It was the look of someone who had just lost a vote.
"Damn," Liam murmured. "This is going to be bad."
And it was. "Thank you for coming here today," Senator Cruz began, speaking without the sheet of notes someone leaned over and placed in front of her. "The last 5 days have been a true test of American fortitude, and I believe I speak not only for my former congressional colleagues, but also for our foreign allies, when I thank you for your cooperation as we begin to roll out our recovery phases. The good news is, we're already 8 days into the first." Cameras click, click, clicked. "I'd like to take the time to walk you through the agreement that we signed this morning. Please save your questions until the very end, when we'll have a few moments to address them." She took a breath, shuffling her papers. "The 4 peacekeeping zones we established will remain in place for the next 4 years. Reconstruction in cities and towns that were decimated by this struggle or by natural disasters for which the government failed to provide aid will be handled by the peacekeeping coalition of countries in each zone, the details of which will be covered in subsequent separate press conferences." She let the audience absorb that before continuing. "Each zone will also be responsible for overseeing the neutralization of Agent Ambrosia in groundwater and wells found within its boundaries, as well as the destruction of any stockpiles of the chemical. Any further use of it throughout the world, as well as any use of Psi-afflicted youth as soldiers, clandestine agents, or government officials in this nation or others is explicitly forbidden by this agreement and will be condemned." Lillian's eyes scanned the room, almost catching mine. She sat up a little straighter and looked pained, clearly knowing what was coming next. "Children remaining in rehabilitation camps will be returned to their families over the course of the next month. We will be providing a searchable database to locate where each child is currently residing, but parents will not be allowed access to the camps. As part of our agreement, they will be destroyed." Shock hit me like a blow to the face. The room began to rumble with voices, low conversations, shouted questions, everything in between. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Grams trying to gauge my reaction, but I couldn't bring myself to tear my eyes from the stage. "The life-saving operation developed by Dr. Lillian Gray will be provided, free of charge, for as long as this terrible mutation exists in our society. Any Psi-afflicted person over the age of 18 will be allowed to decide whether to opt out of the surgery
but will be required to carry special identification. Whether or not a child under the age of 18 receives the treatment will be left to the discretion of their parents or guardians.
Lillian's eyes fell back to the table.
We have set aside several miles of land on which to build a community for any unclaimed child or any child who feels as though they cannot return home safely. We will require that all Psi-afflicted citizens who choose not to undergo the procedure live out the remainder of their lives in one of these communities.
I must have made some noise of disgust because my family turned to look at me. At that same moment, someone on the stage let out a low, furious,
"That is bullshit."
And that someone was Chubbs.
"Hold your tongue!"
One of the men in uniforms was on the receiving end of a glare that would have melted a lesser man into a quivering puddle. Kate looked down at the table, biting her lip in an effort to hide her smile. Senator Cruz coughed, shuffling her papers. Before she could begin speaking again, Chubbs was already midway into his next sentence.
"Let's lay this out fully, shall we?"
he began.
"Oh, Jesus,"
Liam said, looking upward for strength.
"As an 18-year-old,
Chubbs said,
"I finally have the right to choose what I want for myself. But if I make the wrong choice, I'll still be punished for it."
"Please save your questions for the end."
But even as she said it, Senator Cruz made a small, almost imperceptible motion with her hands, as if to encourage him.
"I'm not finished," Chubbs said. "If I were to choose to not have someone, potentially an incompetent someone, cut into my brain, the most important organ in my body, to fix it, then I'm stuck in yet another camp, this time for the rest of my life."
"Oh, I like him," Graham said, delighted.
"It's not a camp," one of the men in uniform said impatiently. "It's a community. Now can we get back to—" "A community with barbed wire fences? Armed guards? You realize that by doing this, all you're accomplishing is reinforcing in America, throughout the world, that the word different means bad, ugly, dangerous. There's no rehabilitation in that. You just want to sweep us under the rug and hope time takes care of us. I'm sorry, but that's pretty damned terrible. And clearly you know it's pretty damned terrible, because you've spent a total of 2 seconds laying out a plan that affects thousands of lives, which have already been ruined by another group of people, some of them probably in this room.
Psi-afflicted humans have abilities that are dangerous and cannot be controlled," the man reasoned. "They can be used as tools for individuals to commit crimes, gain unfair advantages, and harm others."
"Yeah, so can a pile of money. It's what a person chooses to do with their abilities that matters. By locking someone up for making a choice about their body that they have every right to make, what you're essentially saying is that, no, you don't trust us. Not to make good choices, not to treat others well. I find that incredibly insulting. And, by the way, I seem to be in pretty good control of my abilities now, wouldn't you say?"
"You believe children as young as 8, 9, 10 should be allowed to make a life-altering decision?"
Senator Cruz was feeding him a counter-argument to play off of. I sat back slightly, relieved my opinion of her hadn't been far off base. She might have been overruled by the panel she sat with now, but she had found a creative way of getting her point across.
"I'm saying that the kids who've had years of their lives stolen have had time to weigh what they would choose if the opportunity came to be cured of it,"
Chubbs said.
"They've had time to think about what they would choose and can make an educated decision. Trust me, that's all any of us ever thought about, as every hour of every day was controlled down to the minute, or when we had to struggle every day for food and water and shelter while men and women literally hunted us. You're going to set the mark at 18, knowing that 80% of all kids previously interned at a camp can't meet that benchmark? I, at 18, was in a camp for a year. One of my best friends was in hers for 6 years, but she's only 17. She has to subject herself to a decision made by the same people who sent her away in the first place?
I grimaced, fighting not to look over at my parents. I didn't need them feeling any guiltier than they already did.
We need to move on from this topic, another one of the men said. Otherwise, we won't be able to take questions.
I agree, Dr. Gray said suddenly, then clarified, with the young gentleman. Unless they've committed a crime, or the psychological toll of their experiences has impacted their decision-making abilities, or they've harmed someone, I believe the children we take out of the camps should be able to choose. However, parents of children who haven't reached the life or manifest threshold should be allowed to make the decision and will need to do so before their child's 7th birthday. Her voice was strained to the point of fraying, beyond tired. The reporters ate up every single word she offered, jumping to their feet to launch a volley of questions at her, all of which could be summed up as, "Where is President Gray?" Senator Cruz stared at her notes, then asked casually, "Do you believe you could figure out a better system, given what we have to work with?"
"Yes," Chubb said without a hint of arrogance. "And I think if you proceed with this option, you'll not only be ignoring the mental and emotional health needs of the children coming out of the camps, but you'll be condemning them to a life of fear and shame. And if it's going to be that way, then you might as well have left them in the camps."
"Good," Senator Cruz said. "We'll reconvene our discussion on this point following the conclusion of this panel. Should any other Psy-afflicted youth like to join us, please speak to me." In the midst of all of this, someone had disappeared from the front row of seats, a young man in a baseball cap. He'd faded to the outer edge of the room and was moving quickly toward the exit. With his face turned down and his arms crossed over his chest, he could have been anyone, but I knew exactly who he was. I slipped away, waving off Liam's and Vida's questioning eyes, and held up a single finger. I had a feeling this was going to take far longer than a minute, but with Senator Cruz talking again, this time about future congressional and presidential elections, their attention was drawn back to her. The hall outside was 10 degrees cooler than the stuffy sweatbox the ballroom was becoming. I had a feeling he had come out here for the silence, though, more than the cool air. He'd walked nearly to the end of the long hall and taken a seat across from a window overlooking the hotel's parking lot.
"Come to laugh, have you?"
Clancy asked, his voice hoarse. He never turned his head, only kept his eyes trained on the window.
"Enjoy it."
"I'm not here to laugh," I said. He snorted, but said nothing. Eventually, his hands tightened in his lap, clenching and releasing.
"I keep losing feeling in my right fingers. They said they'd never seen the complication before."
I bit back the reflexive, "I'm sorry." I wasn't.
"I told you this would happen, didn't I?"
Clancy said.
"That the choice all of you were stupidly chasing ended up in the hands of the people who put you away in the first place. It didn't have to be this way."
"No," I said pointedly. "It didn't have to." For the first time, he turned and looked directly at me. The recovery from the surgery had drained some of the meat from his bones and the color from his skin. I had a feeling that if I were to lift off the baseball cap, I'd find a newly shaved head and fresh scars hidden there.
"What happened to Nico?"
"Well, I hadn't expected that." "He's here. Didn't you see him?" His shoulders rose and fell with the next deep breath he took in. "Did you want to talk to him about something?
I prompted. Maybe about something you regret?
I only regret losing control of the situation. But it doesn't matter. I can figure a way around this, how to deactivate the device she planted there, how to get everything back. I can do it. I'm closer to the right people than ever. I can find my father, wherever he's hiding. I can do it.
And somehow, I'd known that would be his answer. Because this is who Clancy was at his core. Someone who'd always had everything and still needed more. Still wanted the one thing he'd never, ever be able to achieve. But when he looked at me, his dark eyes sunken back into his skull, it told me something else. That maybe what he really wanted, what he couldn't admit out loud, was the exact same thing his mother had wished for all these years. Pride played a dangerous game in his heart, warring with exhaustion. I felt myself hesitate, fingers curling into fists, as I thought of all the lives he'd played with so callously, the good ones that had been lost, so that he could find ways to survive. And there, too, at the back of my mind, was the boy on the examination table, scared and alone and boiling with helpless hatred. The one with the sweet smile that now lived only in his mother's memory. I knew what he would have done if our situations had been reversed, and I couldn't deny the small voice telling me to do exactly that. Walk away. Let the pain and humiliation grow in him like a cancer until they devoured him. And that alone was a reason to reconsider, because no matter how many times he'd tried, he'd never successfully molded me in his image. And now, he never would. It wasn't to free him of his guilt. It wasn't to punish him. It wasn't anything other than an act of mercy. There were no barriers between us, no blocks. His life spilled through my mind, whirling in colors and sounds I'd never been allowed to see. I'd never been strong enough to find. I took what I could and replaced it with something better. He had never been tested on, never been in Orange, never at East River or in California. There were things I saw, secrets so horrible I'd never wish to inflict on another person by sharing them. I focused on the brightness. I left him with only that, the simple story that he had been with his mother this entire time, that he had helped her all of these years, that the love he still felt for her was a good, pure thing to hold on to. And when I turned to go, releasing his mind for the last time, he looked out the window again at the blackbirds diving and rolling around each other, fluttering across the blue sky, and he smiled. I started back down the hall again, eyes down, thoughts a mess. I didn't see the woman coming out of the ladies' room until I collided with her and ended up with a mouthful of her bright red curls. "I'm sorry," I said, untangling myself. "I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention."
"Lucky for me," the woman said, her voice low and smooth. "I've been trying to track you down for days. How's the leg, kid?"
At that, I looked up, finally realizing who this was. Alice. She'd pulled herself together today. Traded the scrubby jeans and coat I'd seen her in at the meeting point for a full suit that didn't quite fit her. Her hair was a loose, wild mane around her shoulders, held back by a pair of thick framed glasses and a pen she'd probably stuck there and forgot about. "It's been better," I said, eyeing her warily. Seeing that I didn't return her smile, she sighed.
"Look, kid, if this is about me running your story, I'm not going to apologize. I have a duty to report the facts, the truth. And the truth here is that it's a hell of a story. There are a few pieces of information you could fill in for me, if you have a second."
"I don't." Alice shifted uncomfortably, as if just remembering what I was and what I could do. She lowered her voice and glanced around to make sure no one was listening.
I got a tip that Senator Cruz spoke to you and a few others about some kind of program. Top secret stuff. Ballsy of her, considering she just told that whole room that every nation is banned from using you all in any kind of military or clandestine services. I schooled my reaction, keeping it neutral. Not yet. But I didn't doubt that the conversation was coming. I stepped to the side, and she followed me, blocking the way again. If I hadn't been in the mood for this before, I was even less so now. I have to warn you, I really don't respond well to being cornered. Alice held up her hands. All right, all right. Her hand disappeared into the purse looped over her arm, fishing around for something. A business card. If you ever want to talk, she said, you call me any time. I'm all ears. I waited until she disappeared back into the ballroom, then ripped the card in two and let the pieces flutter to the floor. I turned back to the ballroom just in time to see Zoo and Vida come dashing out, holding hands as they ran toward the elevators. A moment later, Liam and a harried-looking Chubbs appeared.
Ah!
Chubbs started to come toward me, his expression narrow.
You should be resting that leg.
Liam released his shoulder and grabbed my hand.
Let's go. Let's go.
What's happening? I asked, glancing into the ballroom as we passed it. Someone was up at the podium making a speech, but the room was otherwise exactly as I'd left it.
Jailbreak,
Liam said, his eyes bright as the elevator opened and he drew us inside.
Trust me.
Fear released its grip on my throat as we rode the elevator all the way down to the underground garage, Liam bouncing on his heels the entire time. Chubbs eyed him warily as we were dragged back out. Liam freed a set of keys from his pocket and held the black plastic fob up, listening for the sound of the lock. Vida and Zoo appeared from behind one of the rows of cars and ran toward the beeping, flashing, dust-splattered SUV with Arizona plates.
You are ridiculous,
Chubbs informed him as he walked toward the car, loosening his tie. But he went anyway, the smallest hint of a smile on his face. I caught Liam's arm, hating the way his expression fell when he saw mine. What's this about? I knew what denial looked like, and this had shades of it, the stubborn unwillingness to acknowledge that something was wrong. Something had overturned inside of him that could never be fully righted.
It's about...
He ran a hand back through his hair.
It's about how everything will be different going forward. You'll go back to Virginia with your family, and I'll go back to North Carolina with mine. And if we want to see each other, I need permission to take the car. You'll need to run it by your parents to get their okay. We'll be living with a set of rules we haven't had in years, and while there's something a little wonderful in that, I just want this. I want to forget for a little while, outrun the hurt. This one last time, I just want to go somewhere no one else can find us.
I smiled, taking his arm when he offered it. He walked us slowly, carefully, around the back of the car. He opened the door and helped me up into the front passenger seat, arranging my awkwardly bulky walking cast with care. He leaned in to buckle my seatbelt, using it as an excuse to kiss me again.
Where are we going?
Chubbs shouted at him as Liam ran around the back of the car to the driver's side door.
Quiet, dear,
Vida said mildly, resting a hand on his leg.
Yes, dear,
Chubbs grumbled back. Next to them, Zoo beamed. I was still smiling when Liam buckled himself in and turned to address the group.
Okay, team, where to? I figure we have about an hour before the conference ends, and for once, we've got gas to burn.
Is this how you got around before? Vida wondered aloud.
It is a miracle you dumbasses survived. Told you,
Chubbs mumbled. I reached back and smacked his arm.
Fine. Okay. Where does everyone want to go?
Beach, 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 beach,
Zoo chanted.
Not sure there's one nearby, so we'll have to take a rain check on that one. Anyone else? Liam asked. Vote?
I don't care, I said, leaning my head back against the seat. Can we just get lost and see where that lands us?
Darling, that is the best damn idea I've heard in a long time. Your navigator, tell me when and where to turn.
He turned the keys in the ignition, letting out a
yes!
As an Allman Brothers song came pouring out of the speakers. By the time we rolled up the ramp and out of the parking garage, even Chubbs's groans had turned to laughter. We drove, winding through the city streets until we found green, tree-lined roads, making our way toward the lazy lines of the river that ran along the curved spine of the city. Liam glanced over at me, taking a break from his off-key crooning. Lit by the warm afternoon sunlight, his fingers entwined with mine over the center console. Zoo rocked in time to the music, chattering excitedly about each and every sign we passed. Chubb slid a book out of the back seat pocket in front of him, examining the cover for a moment before flipping it open. His fingers absently tapped the cracked spine to the beat as Vida leaned against his shoulder and closed her eyes. I brought my window down, letting my free hand drift out to catch the wind, and the open road rolled out in front of us. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of In the Afterlight by Alexandra Bracken. Copyright 2014 by Alexandra Bracken. Performed by Amy McFadden. Directed by Jim Bond. Engineered by Mitch Anderson. Performance copyright 2014 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number. 1-800-222-3225 or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.